Coming up next on This Week in Tech, it's me, Jason Howell, filling in for Leo. One last time, I promise, Leo's going to be back next week. We've got Ant Pruitt, we've got Dan Patterson, and Jason Heiner. And we have a fantastic episode, lots of news to talk about. Substack Notes, how does it compare to Twitter? Does it even compare to Twitter at all? We talk about that. Also, the rules around AI and how many different governments and countries around the world are quickly approaching this point where they feel they need to put some guardrails around the direction of the development of AI. Is it warranted? We talk about that. Morale at Meta, not doing so hot. WWDC and Apple's reality headset, are we actually going to see it in a couple of months? Mark Gurman seems to think that we will. And computer magazines, we shed a single tear, they are no more. This Week in Tech is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 923, recorded Sunday, April 16th, 2023. Intelligence Explosion. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/twit and book a demo today. And by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? Well, the Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by Decisions. Don't let complexity block your company's growth. Decisions no-code, rules-driven process automation software provides every tool needed to build custom workflows, empowering you to modernize legacy systems, ensure regulatory compliance, and renew the customer experience. Visit decisions.com/twit to learn how automating anything can change everything. And by ExpressVPN. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your personal data for profit, it's time to fight back. Get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package by going to expressvpn.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, week 3 of Leo's absence. This week it is I, Jason Howell, sitting in for Leo. So if you are waiting for Leo to suddenly return in his Dr. Evil chair, don't worry. Don't have to wait much longer. Next week's episode, Leo will be back. And we've got a great episode next week in store for you guys. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about our awesome episode that we have today, because this is kind of one of the benefits that we have here when I or Micah or any other, you know, person sits down in the host chair for This Week in Tech. We get to decide who do we want to do the show with. And I got to say, today's panel kind of fell together. I think initially maybe I had already booked you, Dan Patterson, possibly on this episode. And
so.
And that was the beginnings of this. But first of all, welcome to the show, Dan Patterson. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good. And also kind of on the heels of some changes in your professional life. If you want to talk about that for a second, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so I was, in fact, I started my CBS career with Jason Heiner, also on this panel, years ago. And I left CBS to work for a cybersecurity company last summer, and then was, like so many tech people, was laid off a couple weeks ago. And then I'm like a reprise now writing about AI and conducting interviews with AI thought leaders for Jason Heiner. And doing some work for Fortune magazine, for Twit, and a few other outlets. So, I think it's a huge story. This change in our economy, not just with tech, but the tech economy has the New York Times had a great story written today by, Aaron Griffith about the changes in the tech economy and in Silicon Valley. And it's, look, it's not something personal to me. It's impacted so many people that it's It's existential, but it's also, you know, there are practical problems to solve and a great podcast to come on like Twit.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm sorry about the changes in force of transition. No one likes change, but really that happy happens. That we can get you on today. And
that's great to be here.
Yeah, bring you back. So anyways, my story, Dan, you were booked for this. Then suddenly I'm hosting this episode. And then it's Jason great. Heiner... You come along, and I'm like, okay, well, you've got to be on this panel. So Jason Heiner, ZDNet, editor-in-chief. Great to see you, Jason. Just to make things a little bit more complicated, because now there's two Jasons on today's panel.
Yeah, yeah. A pleasure. And when you told me, hey, Dan and Ant are going to be on, I'm like, absolutely, would hang out with all of you all. But I did say... But I have to let you know, Dan's going to be starting some, you know,
didn't know that you know,
contributing to ZDNet for me. And so, you know, thank you for letting us, you know, have half the panel here from ZDNet. But yeah, always a pleasure. And Dan's always been amazing. I followed Dan for many years before we even became friends, and then was lucky enough to hire him when I worked at CBS Interactive. And Tech Republic.
Yes.
And now, you know, here we are again. And also just great to get to hang out with Dan, with you, Jason, and of course, with our good buddy Ant Pruitt, too.
That's right.
I also hired at one point.
I know.
That's true. That's true.
And this is right. This is why I spell out the story, because as the pieces started to fall into place, then I was like, well, Ant's got to be on this episode because he's worked with both of these guys and knows them very well. So Ant Pruitt is here, twit.tv/hands-on-photography or HOP. But, you know, Club Twit manager this week in Google. I mean, doer of so many things here at Twit, and also good friend. Ant, it's great to see you.
And also known as the non-professional here on this week's panel.
Wait a minute. Why do you call yourself the non-professional? You're a professional podcaster. That's all
just,
I am.
Just the regular guy here that's going to sit here and rant every now and then and have a few jaded moments. But I enjoy talking tech with these guys. And
right on.
I'll be brief, but just want to get it out there. These two gentlemen, man, they mean so much to me.
I know
Mr.
do.
Patterson has been a mentor, whether he wants to accept that or not. He's been a mentor to me for several years now. And then I always have much love for Mr. Heiner because he took a shot on me and said, you know what, come over here and give us some stuff to write. And I was just, oh, I love you guys.
Yeah, same.
you paid that back more, you know, in spades, and like what you're, you know, with the great work you do, like you came and when we hired you to write some stuff for Tech Republic and to work for us, like, you know, you hustled so much and did so much, you know, great work communicating, and so glad that, you know, it opened more doors for you. Well-deserved. And obviously the work that you're doing at Twit now, you know, awesome as well. Just right in your wheelhouse too.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're all awesome. Each and every one of you is awesome. This is why this panel needed to happen.
So Jason Howell and I worked together at CNET.
Yeah, I know.
For that as well.
That's true. Well, Dan, I guess you were at CBS.
Web here.
I'm trying to think. I was at CNET until like 2010. I think September 2010 is when I left. Were you at CBS when I was at CNET?
I went to Tech Republic in 2015, CNET in 2018, and CBS.
A little bit later.
News. I was, air quotes, embedded at CBS News a couple months later. Yeah. So I worked out of the broadcast center, but I was at, I split my time with CNET and then full CBS in 2020.
Okay. So you were just a little bit later than my election. Time there, but I consider you and I coworkers to a certain degree.
That's CNET. Like if you worked for CNET, like you always worked for CNET.
Yeah, very true. Very, very true. Well, it's great to get you all on here. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about some of the stories from the past week. Thought we'd start with Substack. We could have started with AI. And honestly, I almost started with AI, but then I was like, I feel like every show starts with AI these days. So let's start with something else and then end up in AI, because that's just where everything's headed here. But Substack, of course, everybody on this panel, very familiar with it. Dan, I know that you have a Substack now, kind of as part of your new thing. This is the the newsletter platform that everybody's pretty familiar with now, has a new feature called Notes, which in, I don't know, in many ways from what I've read, what I've seen of the interface and everything, strikes some similarity with a little social network we're familiar with, Twitter. It rolled out to users on Tuesday. Let's just start with that, because there are other directions that this goes that get a little bit more complicated. But prior to all that, how, well, Dan, let's start with you, because you're the one that's kind of writing content for Substack, for your own Substack. What do you think of Notes? Have you checked it out? Do you feel like it's any sort of threat to anything that Twitter or other social networks have going on? My guess is no.
But I'll start with, with your second question, and that's no. And that is, you know, I think we'll get into the details later. Mechanically, the features on Twitter are pretty easy to mimic and have been for a long time. Look, it was built in Ruby on Rails and later in JavaScript, and it's not a terribly difficult site to recreate mechanically. But of course, as an information network and somewhat of a social network, it's irreplaceable. You can copy some of the features, and Substack has not just a tremendous content network, but a social network. And so it's really great to use Notes and see regular updates from people that I follow or subscribe to, as well as read the long form content that they produce. But in terms of being a Twitter replacement, I don't know that anything is or will be, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Either you, Ant, or Jason, have either of you used Notes, or I don't know.
I'm not the prime candidate because I don't follow a lot of newsletters.
Yeah.
But when I logged into it and took a look at it, I was like, wow, this is a really pretty Twitter. It looked just like a Twitter clone, except it was orange and black instead of blue and black. And I wondered about that, far as would there be some type of, I don't know, is there anything infringing far as how Twitter has their app, their service and platform put together versus what Substack did here? Because you really couldn't tell the two apart unless you look at logos or color scheme or what have you. And far as it replacing Twitter, no, I don't know if anything's going to do that. We've been talking about the Twitter alternative, the Instagram alternative, the Facebook alternative for a decade now. All those cats are still here for a reason. It can't be done.
It's easy to jump to the question, will this replace Twitter in this day and age, you know, year 2023, primarily because we've got all the Elon Musk drama to kind of fuel that question, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, Twitter has, you know, doesn't seem like it's been doing itself any favors. Surely there's someone that's going to swoop in and take the, take what's left and divert people over there.
You know, even with the exodus of people, or so-called exodus of people leaving Twitter, there's still just as many active users going on day in and day out. And some of those are still high profile accounts or celebrities or what have you, because it's fine for broadcasting, if you will. So they didn't go anywhere. All the ads left, or not all the ads, some of the top brands left because they didn't want to be associated with it. But Twitter's still just ticking along because it's just a useful platform for people.
Yeah. I have some challenges with that. I feel like Musk is a controversial figure for a lot of reasons, but I do feel like using it is a little like you're giving tacit permission to some of his behavior. And I don't know that I come down on this as like a binary, like it is absolute one way or the other, but I certainly can empathize with that point of view. I deleted all of my tweets just because I auto delete everything, and I haven't posted in several months. But I continue to log in and check it. Although I think this new algorithm on the For You section, at least, is kind of made a lot of the news features of Twitter fairly worthless. So it's very hard for me to see the news updates that I was pretty accustomed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Twitter, boy, it's a tough one right now, because I do think Twitter in one sense is a, is a caterpillar that's trying to become a butterfly, and nobody knows exactly what that butterfly is or what it looks like or where they're going. I'm not sure Twitter knows.
I think
it might be becoming a moth. It's fair. I think that the interesting thing that Twitter's developing kind of some sharp elbows, which you know, Musk is renowned for in his other companies too. You know, he has some sharp elbows. Like if people criticize and he feels like it's unfair, like he hits back twice as hard. And I think that served some of the businesses that he's in well, because people have done a lot of misrepresenting of SpaceX and Tesla and the way that he has essentially been their PR person. You know, I'd say it's been one of his main jobs, has actually worked well, because it's allowed not other companies to pile a lot of FUD on those companies that are accomplishing a lot of things, but are disrupting a lot of industries. And so, you know, how you all working in the tech industry know how this works. If you're a big company and you're about to be disrupted, you just make up a lot of, you know, really sort of kind of shady things about your competitors and try to pile it on and you be the one to frame who they are. And I think that worked pretty well for Musk. He didn't allow that to happen successfully on SpaceX and Tesla in many ways. It's not working out as well on Twitter, because Twitter, if you're trying to build, and they say they are, we don't know a whole lot about what they're trying to build other than maybe this like super app or perhaps a digital town square. In the digital town square, which is what we can see the most now and where the Substack example comes in, Substack is a great platform. Having a sharp elbow and trying to elbow them out doesn't help Twitter. Ultimately, if you're trying to create a digital town square, you want to create a platform where as many people, as many platforms, as many others can come and build on top of you and be invested in you and then have a place on that and kind of have some ownership of it.
Yeah. The early strategy, sorry to interrupt, but there was
ahead,
early strategy to your point, Jason, was to be, and I mean, long before Twitter had an official app, they were just an API. So you could, in fact, the first interface was 404-404, send a text message and you would get replies. Then they built a web interface, and then they built an API and you could build these apps on top of it. Sorry to interrupt you, Jason, but I think your point was perfect.
No, thanks, Dan. I think that when I read, and it could be me reading what I wanted to hear, when Musk's early rhetoric around Twitter was a little bit of like, I'm going to buy it and take it private. And we're going to go back to a little bit of that reality that you just talked about, Dan. And so, because I think the thing was, if we go private, we don't have to respond every quarter to shareholders. And so we can build something for the long term. And that whole digital town square narrative, for me, that's what that meant. Clearly, that's not quite what Musk meant, or maybe we're just not there yet. But I think like this thing with Substack and some of these other like sharp elbow moments, they're really not helping Twitter or Musk in where they're going. I don't think picking fights with the New York Times and other places, I think those things are working against them in ways that I think has helped him and helped Twitter, Tesla and SpaceX, but don't work very well in sort of the environment that Twitter is in.
Well, it often feels very reactive and unthought through, like this banning of Substack links and mentioning of Substack on Twitter. Of course, you know, the story there, which I'm not sure if it was discussed on last week's Twit, but was that there was this rumor that Substack was going to release this product called Notes. And then, you know, sure enough, soon after that, any mention of Substack, any links out to Substack from Twitter were being blocked. And now that's all been undone. But you know, again, this just being one example, but there's a reactivity that seems to be a part of the perception around the current Twitter and the owner of Twitter, Elon Musk, and that reactivity can damage a brand. But then we've also been saying for, you know, ever since Musk took ownership of Twitter, that he is damaging the service. The service still works. It's still chugging along. So you know what I mean? It's a little bit different now than it was before in a number of ways, but it's still here. There's people obviously still using it. I'm the same as you, Dan. I have my account. I log in to kind of monitor it from time to time, but my once daily habit of checking it and actually posting to it, especially as like the extension, like I hardly do that anymore. I really don't post to it anymore. And I'm definitely not checking it on a daily basis. Does that make something like a Substack Notes, you know, ripe for the picking? I mean, I'm not a author on Substack. I'm also not a regular user of Substack, so maybe I'm just the wrong audience for it. But I would agree with what you said, Ant. I don't know that it necessarily has any sort of threat attached to it of being the next Twitter, if there could be such a thing.
And that's not to diminish it. It's just not necessarily for me because I read a ton of newsletters. You know?
Yeah. And the real glue of Substack is this ancient technology we called email. I mean, it is really a platform that is designed for more passive consumption, less engagement. I know that Notes ups that engagement for particular writers, but it's really designed to be an email platform and something that is slow consumption as opposed to Twitter, which is rapid. One point I do want to make about Musk and his controversial decisions. Jason, I agree with the earned media strategy of be controversial and, as you said, throw some sharp elbows. But he has also elevated a lot of hate speech, and a lot of white supremacists are back on that platform. And there's some challenging stuff that's happening there that gives me a feeling in my stomach that, like, this is not okay. This stuff that, like, strategy aside, you know, we can look at that and kind of pick it apart in kind of a fun way. But the way that pretty terrible stuff has been amplified is distasteful.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Do you think the whole issue with hate speech and all of the horrible content bubbling to the top is because of the lack of resources that he fired once he got in there? And things are slipping through the cracks a lot easier because the team that's right there now, they're busy with a whole bunch of things beyond content moderation.
Yeah. I mean, put it in context, they had 7,000 employees. Now they're down to 1,300, 500 of those are engineers. It is a skeleton crew over there. And we had some problems with the ZDNet account and tried to get a hold of people there. And it took a month. It took over a month, actually.
Wow. A month?
To get in contact with somebody who could it help. You know, everybody had left that work. There were contacts.
Wow. And even prior to what you're talking about, I mean, I remember here at Twit, we've had our run-ins here and there with something that we felt we needed to escalate to the powers that be at Twitter. And even prior to the Muskification of the service, and when they had all of that staff, it still took a while to get there. Not nearly a month, but it still took a while. I mean, any of this stuff is incredibly complicated. And I think this actually ties in with a link that you added, Ant, that does have to do with Substack. And this is on the side of content moderation, right? And we're talking a little bit about, you know, how Twitter has approached content moderation. They're down on staff. So what are the impacts of that? Well, the other side of this is that the Substack CEO, Chris Best, it's hard to understand what the values of Substack are when it comes to moderation. And the point behind this is that he had an interview with Nilay Patel from The Verge, and Nilay really tried to nail him down on the terms of service with Substack, primarily because Substack, the service itself, taking notes to the side, my understanding is the CEO says, you know, Substack has been a delivery mechanism. It's a delivery network. It's not, you know, it's not like a Twitter. It's not like a social network that needs content moderation. We give you the platform and it's a little bit more agnostic from there. Well, now Nilay is saying, okay, well, now you're getting into this other thing, this Notes thing, which is very similar to a Twitter. It's very similar to a social network. How do you approach content moderation now versus what you were doing then? And Nilay, you know, pointed to a very specific part of the terms of service to say, you know, to use the example, I can't remember the example that he used to frame around this, but essentially, here's a really bad thing that's said on your network.
A post that says that there need to be less brown people in America.
Or that brown, yes, something along those lines, exactly. And Neil, I wanted him to say, yes, that is something that we would remove from the network. And CEO, I mean, it's really kind of impressive to kind of like listen and you know, read through the transcript that's here on TechDirt about it. And no matter what Neil I did, the CEO would not confirm that, even though like any CEO of any other social network would very quickly probably step forward, unless, you know, there are certain social networks that maybe they wouldn't step forward and say, heck no, not on my network. But I'd say that most of them, and Twitter included, probably would. And here, not getting so much from Substack. So I don't know. What were you, Ant, you were the one that made sure that this, you know, made it into the rundown today. What are your thoughts on this? Like,
well, I wanted to bring it to the attention of our other hosts, because when I saw this message shared, I knew it was going to have a whole lot of people up in arms and enraged. I get it. But instead of just watching the TikTok that was shared, I went and listened to the actual episode, because I found, this is the jaded side coming out again, a lot of things that are published in social media that are set to just induce outrage tend to be chopped up a certain way to do that. And the context gets all thrown all over the place.
Oh, for sure.
I went back and listened to the whole episode. And prior to that segment, Neelai Patel says, look, I wanted him to answer this question, but I went about it the wrong way. I should have framed it a little bit differently, because the example I gave wasn't a fair example to him, something like that. But the problem was, he still didn't answer the question. That's the thing, because Neelai brought up an example in the terms of service and everything. And after listening to it, I sort of see where the CEO was coming from, because sometimes they don't want to answer things, because they should just keep their mouth shut, because things get worse the more they speak. And I think that was part of it. Maybe had PR there whispering in his ear, but he didn't. So he got quiet. I get that. But at the same time, black and white, hate speech and racism and stuff. Yeah, I would love to have answered no. That's not going to be allowed. But again, I'm not the CEO of some tech company out there. But I wanted to bring it to Mr. Patterson and Mr. Heiner as people in journalism. What are your thoughts on how Neelai went about it? Neelai Patel went about it, as well as your thoughts on the response from the CEO, because you folks deal with people in those higher positions. And a lot of times it's tough to get answers out of them to simple yes no questions.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead, Dan.
I'm waiting for Jason, but I've heard that same answer from every spokesperson at every major tech company for a very long time. I can't speak to how Patel conducted the interview, because I haven't watched the interview. I do think that you need to have an answer for that question, because every journalist is going to ask you about content moderation, and especially algorithmic content moderation. And we certainly see that there are harms. Maria Ressa, the Nobel Prize winner, who was attacked and jailed because of attacks from the president Duterte on her as a journalist, can tell you that there are real harms that come from algorithmic amplification of hate speech.
Yeah.
Now, we are not saying that necessarily that's what Substack is doing, but if I were advising him, I would say that you need to have a good answer to this question, because every spokesperson, I mean, let's go back to Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. Let's extend this to Twitter and other social networks. This is not a new problem. Yeah. And so if you're going to launch a social network, you need to have an answer to this. Even Tumblr, going back years ago, Tumblr had lax policies on porn and nudity, and they changed those not out of pressure from users, but out of pressure from Apple and the iOS rules. Yeah. So you at least need to have an understanding of what your platform allows and what your answer is going to be to those questions, because simply not answering it is
problematic.
Yes. And Dan, you're exactly right. And I think that is a huge part of Neelai's point. And he even says it in the interview, is like, you know, these kinds of things, they broadcast the values of the network that you're using. And as a user, you want to know that those values align with your values. And if your terms of service say this is not okay, then why can't the CEO say this is not okay? And flat out, that CEO was refusing to say this is not okay. Meanwhile, you know, I look at the quote and I don't want to say the quote because it's actually worse than what you even said there, Ant. But, you know, you read a quote like that and you go, yeah, that should not be on a network. At least it does. At least I, as a user, have the value system that says that I don't want to use your network if that is allowed. And I think that's the point.
There's also a challenge. I understand. Look, it's not new to say that you're just a platform and a content delivery network. I mean, that's also a pretty poor answer because every social network has said the same thing going back a very long time. But these are not email protocols, right? These are not open protocols that are used for delivery. These are for-profit venture-backed companies. And so if you're going to put money in your pocket and you amplify hate speech, then I would ask that perhaps you have a better answer, or I'm going to publish your non-answer. Yeah. It's not picking on you. It's not being a jerk. It's just, and it's not just fundamentals of journalism. It's what a lot of people want to know. A lot of your users want to know. Yeah. If you are making money on something, why are you also amplifying hate speech?
And I think Nilay is maybe even a little hard on himself. I think Nilay did an excellent job in this. Like he picked this quote to ask this very difficult and challenging question because it's the fundamental social issue in America, racism, and has been since before America was founded. And it's, we've struggled with it over the last 3 years. It's risen to the top of the attention of people. And for all of those reasons, in America, and this is an American company, to ask that question is very fair. And not only that, he pushed him on it. He didn't let him squirrel out of it once. He kept pushing him on it. And it was fair. He gave him every opportunity to say, this is the kind of thing, even just to say, we find it offensive. We don't want things like this here. And maybe explain, you know, their platform in that light. I have heard, to Dan's point and others, I remember at the founding of Twitter, early days of Twitter, I remember the founders there saying, we don't want to censor anything. Like they started from there. Mm-hmm. Like we just want to be the platform. That didn't last very long, right? It was not a tenable way to be because like Dan said, this is not just a matter of bits of zeros and ones that your platform is the on top of. Like it is a content platform. And when you are a content platform, you are responsible for what goes on in that platform. And it doesn't mean it's easy, and trying to moderate anything is extremely challenging and complex, but that's what you sign up for when you create a platform. And so I think they, them sort of trying to squirrel out of this one, you know, doesn't generate a whole lot of confidence that they understand that fundamental fact.
Yeah, I appreciate y'all bringing up his approach, Nilay Patel's approach to it, and just saying, hey, he actually did a good job. But again, as I continue to listen to the whole segment, what it seemed like was the CEO was struggling with the differentiation between content moderation and everyone's right to free speech, the First Amendment. And excuse me, he actually goes in a little bit more detail about that because it sort of sounded like some of the stuff I've heard from the leadership at Facebook as well as on Twitter saying, you know what, we want our users to be able to speak freely. But they also hate trying to figure out where that fine line is between overt racism and hate, or things that could come off as hate or ignorance or racism or what have you.
But there are a lot of experts. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. I mean, like Elon fired a great expert in this.
Yeah.
Look, he could work with the Atlantic Council. He could, I mean, there's so many experts on it. Like, yes, And you're right. This is a nuanced challenge, especially when we talk about algorithms, yep. right? Because algorithms will surface different things for certain people. But this is not a problem that doesn't have a solution. Yeah. There are experts who can help guide them towards a good solution here.
Yeah.
And again, to not have an answer to that, just it kind of rocks confidence.
I wish he had an answer, because when I was listening to it, I saw where he was coming from. And let me just have y'all step into my shoes for a minute. I can go outside here in my neighborhood, and you know, I'm the only black family in this neighborhood. Totally fine with that. And something can be said to me totally out of the way. And I can look at it as a couple of ways. They're racist or they're jackasses. And most of the time, it's option two, you know, but depending on context and depending on, you know, who... Generally, depending on the context, it's going to define whether something was flat out hate and racism versus someone's just a jerk. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what some people in leadership are struggling with when it comes to these platforms, because sometimes people are just jerks online, not necessarily racist.
Mm. And free speech, the thing that it really does come down to free speech a little bit, because that's essentially what the CEO was bringing it back to. But free speech has its guardrails and it has its limits. And so, you know, the interview could have, since he kept going back to that, the interview could have unpacked that a little bit, you know, more as well, and say that, you know, free speech absolutists only exist in sound bites. They don't exist in reality, right?
That is a great sound bite, Jason. It's true.
Yeah. We'll clip it out and put it as a sound bite in our network. Sure.
Flynn, I mean, it should go without saying, but we should also say it to say it all the time. Tech companies love to wrap themselves around free speech. It has nothing to do with free speech. This has nothing to do with free speech. Free speech is right. And you said it. The government, the First Amendment, the government is not coming in and dictating policy here. No. So wrapping yourself in free speech and saying free speech over and over is, in some ways, I'm not saying that this CEO did it right. It is a cop out, but it's also a diversion. And I know that other tech companies have used it as a specific PR strategy to kind of get you off of the talking point that you're on, or get you off of your line of questioning and start talking about something that everybody goes, oh, I'm for free speech. You know, I'm just asking you a hard question. Right.
It's like, think of the children.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
As a tool. Like, yes. Right.
Right. And so I think it's just, it feels like a specious argument at this point, at this juncture in history. Like, come on, man, let's look at the last decade. There have been CEOs ahead of you who have said the same things, repeated the same talking points. This is not a free speech issue. This is a for-profit issue. The bigger you scale, the more money you make. And so if you're going to scale, then you have to have a better answer about how you deal with hate speech.
100%. Excellent summary. Totally agree. And that was a fantastic first story to dive into. We are going to take a break, and then we're going to have many more fantastic stories to dive into when we're done. So everybody hang tight for the moment. Let's take a moment and thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, and that is Collide. So Collide has some big news. So first of all, Collide, if you don't know, it's a device trust solution. It ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. So there's that. Well, they got some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance. It can do that. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture, and that's device compliance. So when you really think about it, your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps, right? If they're known, sure, they can log in. But just because a device is known doesn't always mean that it's in a secure state. Is it secured? You don't actually know that. Just because it's known, it doesn't tell you that it is. In fact, plenty of the devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted at all. Maybe they're running an out-of-date OS version. Maybe they've got unencrypted credentials just lying around. If a device isn't compliant, or if it isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources, plain and simple. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they've actually fixed the problem on their end. So a device might be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser, for example. Using end-user remediation actually helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overwhelming your IT team. So it keeps things a little bit simpler on your end as well. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or to stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet. And it doesn't matter which, you know, which OS, Mac, Windows, Linux, doesn't matter. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. So that's when the user logs in with Okta. Collide actually alerts them to compliance issues. It prevents unsecured devices from logging in, full stop. It's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it all up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, yay, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance, and that's going to keep everyone safer. Visit collide.com/twit, and you can learn more. You can actually book a demo there as well. That's K-O-L-I-D-E, that's collide.com/twit, and we thank Collide for their support of This Week in Tech. What about, I'm going to get off Twitter for Twitter. I know it was Substack, but everything seems to come back to Twitter these days. So I'm going to venture away from Twitter a little bit, give ourselves a little Twitter break, and talk a little bit about AI. Because before we kind of get into some of this AI news, Dan, you're doing a lot of thinking and writing about this stuff, right?
Yeah, for Jason, in fact, for the last month and ongoing, I've been interviewing thought leaders in AI. So most recently, Ben Gertzel, he developed Sophia the Robot, which is this anthropomorphized AI, and Pascal Kaufman, who's a neuroscientist in Switzerland. Philip Rosedale, who was the founder of Second Life, really fascinating personalities, and everything from like the path from, these large language models and, ChatGPT all the way up to AGI, artificial general intelligence, which it's kind of a moving goalpost, but it's the, in theory, AI that is as smarter than humans, but also, I mean, definitely keeping with a lot of what is on ZDNet, the practical stuff, right? The kitchen table. What does this mean for business? What does this mean for you at home? And so a lot of these people are talking to me about like, well, there's going to be some big changes coming to search. There are going to be some big changes coming to, you know, consumers for sure, but business is going to be, enterprise business is going to be changed fundamentally by a lot of these, more practical AI models.
Interesting. I mean, fascinating place where we are at with AI, and you know, get a little confusing because it's going in all sorts of different directions. I labeled this taming the AI race because, you know, this is just kind of a little chance to see how everybody is approaching AI when it comes to, particularly when it comes to government, because, you know, they're increasingly, it looks like, across the world, there's a lot more attention, a lot more understanding, maybe not of the technology itself, but of this thought that AI could someday be so good that what the heck does that mean about the people who are in power, the countries who are in power, how the lives for the people living within those countries, how are they impacted? There's just a number of things happening right now. The U.S. Commerce Department, this was last Tuesday, requested public comment on creating accountability measures for AI. So they're seeking people, and we talked about this a little bit and on This Week in Google, but they're seeking the input of people who understand and know the potential kind of, the potential path that AI is on and what it could lead to. What are the right questions to be asking so that on a governmental level, they can create, potentially create guardrails around the development of AI. And this is just one example. You know, in Europe, they're creating a task force, Europe's national, the European Data Protection Board, the EDPB, is looking to kind of get a better understanding of creating this, like this group to really understand the development of AI. China's doing the same thing. They're mandating security reviews for AI. So I don't know if that means that they're one step ahead. You know, they're out of the analysis phase and they're more in the reactive phase. But everybody seems to be understanding that this looming development of AI, where we are right now and the explosive growth that it's seen, especially in the last 6 months, is leading to something, and we don't know what it is, but we want to understand what it is and possibly control where that is headed. So, Dan, let's start with you, because you're writing about this stuff a lot. Like, where is your mind when it comes to this movement, this kind of like all, you know, all-encompassing worldwide movement towards respecting the power of AI and wanting to put guardrails there? What are your thoughts?
Well, I hope we can regulate it better than we did social media and have a little more nuanced and sophisticated take by our elected representatives than we have had in the past. Ant, you just, you've got a take?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Dan, because government is wanting to try to figure this stuff out, and you've been speaking with experts. Actually, it's two things. From a government standpoint, experts that are out there that you've been speaking to, are they willing to go to government and try to help, you know, figure out a way to do some type of regulation or set up better guardrails? Or are they just saying, no, we don't want to get the government involved, because when the government gets involved, things get weird and sometimes really, really screwed up? And secondly, you mentioned from an enterprise perspective with AI, you know, we've been speaking about AI for 3 months now. I swear it seems like 3 months. And the stories are either really, really big, rah, 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 where AI is awesome, or gloom and doom on the other side of things, never really much of a middle ground. But what on the enterprise side of things is making this something that could be really, really practical? Because speaking as a creative, I could see where AI can hop in and make things better for me. Mm-hmm. And I have used it recently for things to make it better in a workflow standpoint. But enterprise, I can't really wrap my head around it, probably because I've been away from it for quite a while now. But what is AI going to do on the enterprise side of things?
Well, you know, and actually, I'm very curious when it comes to regulation. I don't know. But to your point about being a creative, in fact, I sent Jason Heiner a text message maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks ago about how I'm using ChatGPT to write stories. Now, they're not writing stories for me. It's right. Poor quality if you try to do that. But a lot of my reporting is interviews with primary subjects. And any reporter can tell you, like, okay, you conduct an interview, but then you have to often transcribe the interview, and then you have to pull out quotes, and then you have to pull out the salient points, and then you have to create an outline. Yeah. And, you know, that's the first thing I do is create my outline.
Yep.
But, you know, that whole process can take several hours. And for some people, I'm a slow writer, so for some people it can take longer than that. What I have used ChatGPT for is, hey, please summarize this transcript, pull out the 5 most interesting quotes. And of course you go back and you check it and you know, change it. It's not always the best, mm-hmm, but it does mm-hmm. a pretty good job of finding those quotes and then pull out the main points of what this person talked about. And I'm telling you, I've used it for every single story I've written for Jason in that same way. And it's mm-hmm. great. It saves a ton of time. It compresses the amount of time I would spend doing those kind of routine maintenance tasks, and yes, allows me to think about the story. And I think write better stories because yes. I'm spending more time writing and less time doing all of the mechanics.
Yep. Yep.
But I'm curious what Jason has to say, Heiner has to say about the enterprise, because that's going to be a whole huge shift.
Yeah. So it really comes down to one thing primarily, which is automation.
Okay.
And they've been working on this for a long time, right? And part of, I think, what the new level of generative AI could do is we've been able to automate like one little thing here. And I think that this is like what we're seeing is like the ability to create a string of these automations that then all of a sudden is like you've taken a big chunk of the really repetitive, mind-numbing, mm-hmm. you know, work out of it. And when we really thought this was going to happen, and it really has been happening with manufacturing for, you know, a long time. Uh-huh. But now it's happening with a lot of the knowledge work, right? Because we're realizing ChatGPT is helping us to realize, to just the point that Dan did, that there's a lot of repetitive things that are somewhat easy to automate. In Dan's latest interview, Gertzel says, he says, what we've discovered is you don't have to be particularly innovative to automate a lot of knowledge work. Shockingly, you know, I'm summing it up. That's like my, you know, summing it. But watch the interview. It's an awesome interview. It's only 20 minutes. You will be thankful that you did. But I think his point is that there's a lot of opportunities for automation that really were kind of not on our radar. And now we're realizing, you know, like that. I would be interested to hear the ones that you're using. And you alluded to the fact that it's enabled you to streamline a couple things with your creative workflows.
There's some things inside of Photoshop or inside of like DaVinci Resolve that utilizes AI in the GPU on your computer. Inside of Photoshop, if you're trying to cut someone out of a background, that used to be a tedious process of going through and making the selection properly, especially if they had hair, unlike myself, and pulling them out cleanly to put them on a different type of background. And now it is literally one click and it's done in about 3 seconds of analysis, and Adobe Sensei, its AI will fix it and pull it out for you, and it's done. And on DaVinci Resolve, doing that inside of video, it's even more task intensive there. But with the AI, it's literally just click and drag, and it does a selection and pulls it right out within a couple of seconds. It's really fascinating. And you're talking about automation and enterprise. It sort of reminds me of the recent episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech here on Twit TV. There was a security story where some employees were terminated, but yet their credentials were still available to them down the road months later because there was a checklist that got missed, you know, and maybe they couldn't log into this box or server or what have you, but they could log into this one and things like that. And I was thinking about, because I haven't seen Microsoft Active Directory in probably 10 years now. And I remember we had processes and procedures and going through and making sure everybody got ticked off. The boxes got ticked off when people were terminated, because there was all types of group policies and security measures for, you know, they could access this folder and that folder and so forth. And I was like, I thought you could script a lot of that stuff, but apparently you can't script everything. But if AI can come in and help do, I guess, a bunch of scripts and put it into one, maybe that's a game changer.
My mind is swirling right now as I think about this, because I'm thinking about the example that you just gave, Ant, where, you know, removing people in the background, which, by the way, I can do on my phone, right? Like, and of course, Google is quick to tout, you know, that's the power of machine
and it's
learning.
AI. TensorFlow. What was it? TensorFlow. Yeah.
And the fear that a lot of people have about AI eliminating jobs or, you know, taking.
Oh, crap.
And that whole aspect of things. But when I hear what you're talking about, I hear it as a tool that helps someone who knows what they're doing do better at their job, do more with their job in other ways, right? But I can see the flip side of this. We also have a story a little bit further down the rundown, line 63, that kind of focuses on illustrators, video game illustrators in China. It's an article on Rest of World, which is a fantastic site. And it just kind of focuses on a handful of examples of where, you know, one of the examples is a freelance illustrator You know, used to make $430 to $1,000 ish for every video game poster she drew. Since February, those opportunities have dried up because, I mean, as you can imagine, as we've seen from generative AI, doing illustrations like that kind of come a lot easier to a system like that. And so now the work that she's
doing with our thumbnails, you know, we do it for several of our shows have used some AI generated art for thumbnails and it looked great.
Sure.
And I get where this where the people are coming from here in this story. And my suggestion to folks that are in that situation is, all right, well, the next move would be to pivot into figuring out prompts, because there is,
how do you use it?
It's an art to write in those prompts.
Yeah, you know,
I can put in Midjourney or Stable Diffusion, give me two dogs playing in the field, and it'll give me two dogs running, playing in the field. But someone else can come in and say, hey, how about make it have professional lighting with vibrant green grass? And it's at golden hour. You know, they knew the nuance of crafting that prompt to make that image look even better.
There's an imaginative quality to it. This is actually, and I realize I don't have that, or I'm not practicing.
I don't either.
Yeah. Like when I'm putting together prompts, you know, like I haven't done many of them. And granted, I'd probably get better if I really spent the time understanding these prompts and everything. But man, when
stories on ZDNet that can help you with that.
I'm sure there are. I've read some of the stories, right? And I'd be like, okay, I'm going to get good at this because I should really know how to do this. Otherwise, this whole thing's going to pass me by. And every time I sit down to do it, I'm super underwhelmed with what I come up with. And I just realize, like, I think what I respect about the people who can write these prompts is it takes in a certain quality of imagination to be able to visualize, at least when we're talking image generative AI. You have to visualize in your mind exactly what you want to see, the details that are important, the style that's important. Yeah, there's some modifiers in the syntax that if you know how to do those, you're going to get a higher quality output and that sort of thing.
Yep.
But you really kind of have to create the image in your mind before you ever put it into a prompt. And I am very unskilled in that. That is very apparent to me.
You know, but
so
that's what
bad respect
saying.
For
Someone
those who can do it.
Really skilled at doing the video game art, as if the way these illustrators are describing, they're visualizing that stuff as they put in stylus to Illustrator or what have you. So, and I know it's easier for me to say it than done, but take that same imagination and put it into text. You know, just.
Yeah, and we
don't get yourself knocked out of this game. Don't hate on the game. Just go get better at the game, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, the example you gave is a good one, Ant, of like we used to pay somebody probably $35 to $75 an hour that would take them an hour to maybe 4 hours to do what the AI does in 3 seconds now.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of those people, they are who got paid to do that. You know, now that has been a kind of a slow burn. Like some of that work has been, you know, been slowly automated over by the software over a number of years here. But what we know is those people have a lot of really important and valuable things to do. Like most of them are still employed. They're just doing either more work, getting more done faster, or they're also taking on other work and doing additional work.
Yep.
And we've seen this throughout human history too. Like if we zoom out just one level further, you know, every time there's been a new level of automation, it kind of does two things. One, everybody says there's not going to be any jobs. Like from the time the Industrial Revolution came around, right? It was like, when cars came around, when the plane came around, you know, all
it disrupts
these,
the status quo.
Things.
It disrupts what was normal prior to, and that's scary because it's changed. You know,
it does, we see it with layoffs too, right? When there's a bunch of layoffs, like there have been recently, what we learn often through that process is one of the greatest resources in human history has been boredom. Because when people are laid off or don't have work, what do? They typically have time and they often have ideas, and now they have time to go work on those ideas. And those ideas are often what germinates like this next wave of whatever invention, innovation, even efficiency, all of those things. And so we've seen that, you know, human beings do sort of do that work, like you're talking about, Jason Howell, of like they have ideas in their heads, and a lot of times their limitation is resources or time, and time and resources are often very closely connected.
Yeah.
And so what we see is that there's always a new burst of energy and creativity, you know, from you know, very disruptive moments like this. And so I think from that sense, it doesn't mean it's not difficult or challenging or uncomfortable, because it is, but I think we should draw some hope from that's likely this and what's happening now is likely to power a new wave of creativity and innovation and invention. And it probably will mean people working less. Right. Mm-hmm. It'll probably mean people can get more done in less time. Mm-hmm. It may mean four-day work week. Right. It might mean, you know, not people having to put as much time in, but can still get the same amount of productivity, perhaps more productivity out of less time. Those would all be excellent, you know, long-term benefits.
There's a former CEO in my past company I worked at umpteen years ago, and it was data entry. And we moved into doing the client would do their own data entry online and just upload it to us. And I remember all of my coworkers were up in arms, like, oh, my goodness, we're going to get laid off because they're doing their own work and yada, 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 yada. Mm-hmm. And I remember our CEO at the time, that man is so dadgum awesome. His track record is just unbelievable. But he came out to us and he says, you know what? Yes, they're going to do that upload and send it to us and we can check it. But what that's going to do is free you up to do some things with more brain power and go in and be able to be more analytical and branch out into other things and help us with these other processes and maybe even build something else and put your name on it, because it's just going to make it better and just free you up to expand on this extra time that you're going to have to make something bigger and better. You know, and he nailed it, you know, because things did get better after that.
I'll give you one very recent example, because in these conversations, everyone's like, well, can you give me an example of how things are going to change, mm-hmm. but be okay? And to Jason Heiner's point, now it wasn't as hyperbolic with, or it hyped with consumers, mm-hmm. but in the business, in B2B tech, when the cloud came, when the cloud was introduced, there was so much angst and worry about this is going to just take every job.
Yeah.
And instead, what it did is allowed companies to scale and add new jobs.
Yep. Mm. Got more engineers.
Mm-hmm. More engineers.
Got more engineers. Sure.
Okay. So then go back to now, considering all that as extra kind of context behind the initial story here, with all governments around the world feeling like this is a moment in time where something needs to be done. We know that AI is important. We know that it has the potential to change things drastically, but we need to understand the technology. We need to figure out how we put in these guardrails. Like, is that an appropriate response to what you're saying now? Because if we've gone through this with cloud as one example, like, I mean, I don't know. You tell me. Did the government get freaked out about the potential of the cloud to destroy, you know, jobs and change lives to the point to where they felt they needed to put in serious guardrails to protect, in some cases, in some people's view, not just jobs, but humanity as a whole, which personally I feel is pretty far overblown. But hey, you know, maybe it's not. But I don't know. Is that an appropriate response? What do you think?
It is. It's a good place. Look, this is a good place for government to step in and play referee, right? That's often the best place for the government to be, not to play, a centralized source for all of the answers, but a place that helps to set the rules of the game and make sure people are playing by those rules in ways that are fair and that are not going to have very negative effects on, people, or create levels of, danger, inequality, violence, all of those kinds of things. And there are real dangers with a lot of these generative AI models, right? You can use them to say, what's the best way to create a bomb? And then what's the most effective place to put it in this building so that I can collapse the whole thing, right? These generative AI models that have all of this data, these large language models that can process all this data, it could give you a very good answer to that. Now, to be fair, ChatGPT is actively working on putting their own guardrails in place, which is good. But I think we don't want to just leave it to the goodwill of companies to do the right thing. That's a place where I think the public, us as the public, the whole public, I think we want to have a say in that. And that's where the government comes in, right? And like being the referee, setting the rules and making sure people are playing by those rules, and for there to be stiff penalties if they aren't, because it can have very negative effects, you know, socially, and affect lives and incomes and all of these things. It's not easy, or it's very, also very complex, but I think these are the things that we want. This is a good place for government to put its energies to, rather than some other things that sometimes are not very fruitful or efficient.
It'll be interesting.
Go down.
Oh, it'll be interesting to watch how different regions adapt. Here in the States for sure. And we have an interesting approach to our government and their sophistication and tech regulation. People have very strong opinions about that. But joking aside, look, Ben Goetzel is based, or was recently based, in Hong Kong. And Pascal Kaufman is based in Switzerland. Some of the best AI thinkers are in totally disparate regions. And those regions, just like with social media, will have different approaches to AI regulation. But we know with technology, it's diffuse. It will propagate no matter what. And so the technology that powers this will fundamentally make changes whether we regulate it or not.
Yeah, there's only so much that we can do to a certain degree about how it's going to develop. For sure, that is true. Jason, I believe you had mentioned, you know, OpenAI kind of throttling themselves. There's actually a story. Sam Altman, who is OpenAI's CEO and co-founder, had confirmed that they are not training GPT-5 at this point. As we know, GPT-3 came out, wowed the socks off of everybody, and then GPT-4 came out, and I don't know how they did it with that, but people were absolutely blown away. That's I feel, when the conversation of, Oh my God, like, what have we got ourselves into, started to really ramp up, because people saw how damn good GPT-4 was. And of course, you know, these are for-profit companies, so you know, we kind of assume they're working on their latest and greatest, and they might very well be, but Sam is saying that they're not currently training GPT-5, you know, and so maybe that will calm your nerves a little bit. I don't know, you know, anyone who's really worried about this stuff, I don't know how far that would go to calm your nerves, but there. He also said that the size of large language models won't matter. I thought this was kind of interesting because, you know, we're so used to in technology talking about, you know, specs and you know, bigger, better, faster, that sort of stuff. And so, of course, you know, a larger data set for large language models would be better than a smaller one. But Sam Altman had said, he did an interview for the Imagination in Action event at MIT just a couple of days ago, and kind of likened it to where we are with smartphones, how for the longest time these things were all about, you know, bigger, better, faster, what's the speed, what's the memory, blah, blah, blah. And that now we're at a point to where that kind of stuff doesn't matter nearly as much. It's just they're much more efficient. They're able to do more with less. And so he sees that being a case with these large language models going forward. He's a smart guy, so he might be onto something. But yeah. All right. Well, we've got more to discuss here coming up. But first, let's take a break. And then when we come back, I don't know, what do you all want to talk about? I mean, I guess we could stick on the AI beat. Actually, we can kind of do a little bit of an Oreo cookie, because we can take AI and Twitter and sandwich them together, because AI apparently wants to get in, or Twitter apparently wants to get in on the AI game. So that's coming up here in a moment. But first, this episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Cisco Meraki, the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid at work, whether your employees are working at home, maybe they're working at a cabin in the mountains, or they're sitting in a lounge chair at the beach working. That's my favorite. I would love to be working at a beach in a lounge chair. A cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. You may as well roll out the welcome mat, hybrid work. It's not going anywhere. Hybrid work works best in the cloud. It has its perks for both employees and leaders. Workers, of course, can move faster. It can deliver better results, especially when you're using a cloud-managed network. Leaders can automate distributed operations. They can build more sustainable workspaces, and you can proactively protect the network. An IDG Market Pulse Research report conducted for Meraki highlights top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Now, hybrid work is a priority for 78% of C-suite executives, according to this report. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward while also staying on top of, or in fact, boosting productivity and security. But as we know, hybrid work, it has its challenges, big challenges. The IDG report raises the red flag about security. It notes that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. Always-on security monitoring is part of what makes the cloud-managed network so awesome. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners. These are turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform. And you can do a number of things. You can asset track, you can use their location analytics, and a whole lot more. And by using Meraki for all of this, you get insights on how people are using their workspaces. So environmental sensors, for example, can track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness and other things. You can reserve workspaces. So, based on vacancy and employees' profiles, which you may have heard, referred to as hot desking, locations in restricted environments can be booked in advance and include time-based door access. And then mobile device management, that's integrating devices and systems to allow IT to manage, to update, to troubleshoot company-owned devices, even when the device and employee are in a remote location. So in essence, you can turn any space into a place of productivity. You can empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work when you're using Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. It's really great. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. That's meraki.cisco.com/twit. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. All right. So let's see here. So earlier this week, Twitter, it was noticed, it was discovered that in a court filing that Twitter is no longer Twitter. I mean, the service is Twitter, but the company that owns Twitter is no longer Twitter. It's now a company called X Corp. So basically, Twitter ceased to exist as an independent company, merged with this new shell company called X Corp. Of course, Elon Musk is behind this. And I don't know, it's kind of interesting. Like when I first was reading this and thinking about it, I was thinking of it as like, oh, so, Facebook did this and they became Meta. Google did this and they became Alphabet. So this is the same thing, right? And I think that, yes, it probably is very similar to that. But it all seems to hinge on this idea. Well, it goes in a couple of different directions. The first direction that we knew prior to the AI stuff is that we knew that Elon Musk has been talking for a while about this super app, like a WeChat style app that manages all sorts of things. It's not just a social network. It's also a payments platform, does all these things. It's meant to do everything. That's why they call it an everything app. And that this move into this structure would enable that to be, would enable that to happen, essentially. But we also heard just a couple of days ago that Elon Musk created a new artificial intelligence company called X.AI. So apparently Elon Musk loves the letter X. So many things in his life, have X involved. This is just yet another thing. He, of course, Elon Musk is going to want to get into the AI game. And this seems to be a part of that. So I guess we could start there. How do we feel about Elon Musk making yet another big change to Twitter? But this one, I don't know, I guess from a business sense, it kind of makes sense. But what do you guys
think? Didn't he have some beef with OpenAI? Like,
he was a co-founder, if I'm not mistaken, of OpenAI back in 2018. Is it? He kind of had he I don't know if you call it a falling out, but essentially mm-hmm. he stepped away from OpenAI. He was concerned about the direction of artificial intelligence. So yeah, it's an interesting point to bring up, Ant, because he has been one of the people in recent years sounding alarm bells about the potential of AI and the development of it, and being, you know, sometimes going to that extra level, that extra like AI sentience level, and you know, it'd be easy to kind of write him off as silly as a result of that. But it, you know, there's that, and then now what's happening? Well, he wants to get in on AI once again. So I wonder, are his intentions different? Does he want to do AI in his mind responsibly? Put that in air quotes. I don't know. Do we have any thoughts as far as like what his plan might be, his master plan?
I think, to be clear, with OpenAI, I understand it, and Sam Altman's take on it, you know, Elon's thing is like, I didn't create OpenAI so that it could become, you know, controlled by Microsoft, right? Or another corporate
open
entity. Meant to be open.
Yeah.
Now, Sam Altman's take is that when they got to a point in OpenAI, they realized in order to get to the level of magnitude and scale they wanted, it was going to take a lot of servers and a lot of server power, and they weren't getting the donations for it to really scale it. They weren't getting the rocket fuel they needed. And so that's why they had to go to find some corporate partners. But what he says is the way their board is set up, that the nonprofit board for OpenAI still controls the ultimate destiny of it. And so there is some, and Elon wasn't happy with that, still isn't happy with it. That said, you know, Elon's trying to do this in a private company setting Twitter. So with 1,300 employees, it's hard to see a very good trajectory where, you know, they could make a dent in the universe with it from a Twitter standpoint. And I think that they have enough things on their plate that it doesn't seem very likely to have a large impact anytime soon. That said, I'd be surprised if not just. So I kind of think of it as a non-story, other than the fact that they want to get into it. Anybody that's starting a company or transforming their company right now, if they don't have AI as part of their, you know, mandate, then they're probably, you know, not thinking of it right. Whether you make toilet paper or whether you make, you know, open platforms to grow the to be a platform for the internet or a super app.
I mean, that's go, Dan.
A lot of tech stories, the dynamics, the interpersonal dynamics are far more interesting than the tech dynamics. And that relationship that he's had with OpenAI and Microsoft has been pretty interesting. What he's referring to with this, he's talked for a long time about AI. What he's referring to is the paperclip maximizer, which was a phrase coined by Nick Bostrom in his book Superintelligence, which was published in 2013, and has kind of defined the macro AI environment for a long time. Not the smaller and more practical business sense, but there's kind of a cult of people. Maybe I shouldn't use the word cult, but there are adherents. Well, I misspoke, but there are adherents to this idea of AI superintelligence. And that is not just AGI, but the rapid leap. There's an intelligence explosion beyond just these really useful models and AGI, and that artificial superintelligence will happen rapidly. And that superintelligence, the values of a machine superintelligence aren't aligned with human values. And so the paperclip maximizer comes in with this idea that, well, if we train an AI to create paperclips and we say make paperclips at the expense of everything else, make paperclips very efficiently, then that AI will have a very narrow value set and it will say, okay, no problem. Doesn't matter if people use the paperclips. I am going to atomize everything in the universe and create paperclips.
Yeah.
It's kind of a ridiculous thought experiment, but there are many people in the Valley now talking about this as an existential threat. They often don't talk about climate change, but do talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Interesting, isn't it? All right. So then
you mentioned the super app thing. And I can remember this was brought up way before the actual purchase happened. And it seemed to be a bit controversial amongst some of the other pundits here at Twit. And I didn't think it was a bad idea, considering we have the likes of the WeChat and so forth that's going on in Asia, and it seems to be working. But I'm not sitting here saying I want a Twitter super app and would put my financial information into it. But I don't see anything wrong with this premise of saying, let's have a super app where we can have messages here, social here, share our, you know, send beer money to our buddy, you know, whatever.
We already have it, though?
Yeah, I was like, just going to say, isn't that like Twitter with like an extra payment layer? Is that a super app? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's like right. Android or iOS. Like, yeah, I have an app that does it. It's called Venmo. I have an app that orders cars. It's called Uber. It does it like if I do it in one app, does that change my experience? Not really. I mean, that story kind of misses all of the subsidy, like the way China has subsidized the growth of WeChat. I mean, sure, I would love to see him try. And I'm not anti-Musk. Okay, great. Please try. Yeah. I'm just skeptical. And it's an operating system. The super app is an operating system. It lets you do all of these things.
Yeah. The super app needs network effects too. Yeah. Right? Like it operates on network effects of like people are in your ecosystem. And so you just make it easier to do other things in your ecosystem. And then it just grows naturally. I think Twitter is going to have a really hard time creating that kind of level of network effect. If somebody was going to make the super app, I think it's somebody who already has some of those network effects, or that's going to create something so much better than something we have now, whether it be a social network, whether it be way to send something or start a business and spin up my own thing that and take payments from other people, something like that. That's who's going to have the next super app. I think
Facebook
Twitter's
be more suited.
Facebook would be more suited. And frankly, Apple probably would too, right? Because now Apple is on a billion devices. If Apple makes but what Apple would have to do, which maybe they do, maybe they don't, but they might, considering how fast and how far they've gone into services, is that they might make $100 phone. If they make $100 phone that's people's hands,
that is so smart. Yeah.
Yeah. They would crush this if they made $100 phone.
Yeah.
That actually, that actually draws a line to a story that's further down in the rundown, but that I thought was really interesting. I've for those who don't know, I host a show on this network called All About Android. So it's very focused on Android. I've been doing Android for as long as I've had a smartphone. I've had an Android phone, and I've always thought of Android devices as the kind of prime device for not much money. I mean, which is not to say all Android phones are like that, but if you don't have a lot of money to spend on a smartphone, chances are you're probably going to be getting an Android phone. But there is a story in here from the Wall Street Journal that is just pointing to how Apple is gradually over time becoming the low cost smartphone pick. Primarily because, for a number of reasons, but they hold their value. They're built to the point to where an older iPhone still has an excellent chip, that's comparable to a current chip and all of these things. And just how the time that we're in now is more ripe for people being open to having these devices longer and being open to using older devices versus where we were 5-7 years ago, where we were worshiping the premium and it was all premium worship, you know? Now it's like I can only use myself. I can use myself as an example. My older daughter, she's 13. We finally, you know, said, okay, you really want a smartphone. We'll let you get a smartphone, but we got rules, you know, around this. If you want one for free, father, who is a host of an Android show, I have a drawer full of phones. You can use one if you like, and you can have it for free. And
she's here's like, a G1 for you. Here's a Nexus. Yeah. 5
Thankfully, for I have more modern phones than that. She would only be like one generation out, let's say. And she said, no, I want an iPhone, you know, because all of her friends have an iPhone. And so what did we do? We went on to, what service did we use? I think actually we ended up buying it through Amazon, but we looked on Swappa. We looked on all these other like third party or, secondhand, refurbished, Apple refurbished. And we ended up getting her an iPhone SE from 2020. So it's 2 years old, but it has an excellent, you know, rocket chip in it. It's going to be great for her. She loves it. It's perfect for her. And it was like $150, you know? So we're talking this like low end cost. Like what would she have gotten for $150 in the world of Android? Probably not something as strong and powerful as what she did get.
A remote control.
So yeah, right. So anyways, this kind of correlates with that. Another strength that Apple has going for it is it's becoming a pick for that low mid tier. You know, it's finally they're getting those phones, particularly in the refurb or in the secondhand market. You know, those powerful enough phones are not that expensive at all. So I think you're right. I think it's a stretch to think that Apple would release a $100 phone, but my gosh, if they did, they'd be on
$299 maybe.
Yeah, totally.
Know. Yeah.
Couldn't see it happen at $100, but I suppose you never know. Let's see here. Speaking of Apple, I like rumor stories. Some people are like anti-rumor stories because they're not real and blah, 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 but I find them fun. So I thought maybe...
Give us the goods. Let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, I mean... I just thought this was interesting. So I got back a week ago from a vacation. I was gone for 2.5 weeks. And so that whole time I was like completely oblivious to anything technology news. Like I made it a true like vacation from tech news, and it was wonderful. But as you all know, the flip side of this is when you get back to work, you got a lot of catch up to do. So I wasn't aware that apparently it's at least according to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, it's pretty much a lock that we're actually going to finally hear about Apple's virtual reality or whatever they're calling it, the reality headset at WWDC this year. So I don't know. I feel like we've heard this many times before and it keeps not happening, but Garmin seems pretty solid on the fact that this is going to be the WWDC where you see it, period. And he's got a great track record.
The timing could not be worse.
I totally agree. That's why I wanted to talk about it.
If Apple does release this headset, and I'm starting to doubt if they will actually release it. It's also not beyond them to just say, you know what, let's pull this back.
Scrap it.
And not do it. Wait. Because Disney just canceled their whole division that's making content for Metaverse.
They don't Meta huge that. Layoffs in, yes. in Metaverse.
Even yes. even Mark Zuckerberg is quitting the Metaverse. And if Mark Zuckerberg is quitting the Metaverse, then it probably is over.
I mean, he went all in. He did about the biggest thing you could do with the Metaverse. Right. He changed his name to the Metaverse.
I know. I mean, he might as well have burned $10 billion.
Oh my goodness.
Me.
Yes. So Zuckerberg is pretty much done with that whole world. I didn't know this.
He's shifting to AI. Like they got burned so badly on it and it tanked their stock price. And I think he's under a lot of pressure. You know, from the company. I mean, he's under as much pressure as he can be under. He has this controlling.
Oh, everyone I talk to at Facebook is like, it's layoff watch. Like, nobody's getting work done. They're all just sitting around waiting to get laid off.
Oh my goodness. Dang. That's horrible.
Wow.
That's no fun at all.
So I just can't, I just don't know that I see now Apple could be really take a position where they're going to say, we're going to zig when everybody else zags. They love to do that, as everybody knows. But, you know, this was already sort of it. They had been ratcheting back. They've had leaks. They've leaked stuff to the press. You know, I think these are pretty clearly leaks in some sense that they're only going to have 500,000 units, that it's going to charge $3,000. It's really going to be more of a developer device to get people excited about the metaverse.
So it's Google Glass all over again.
It does, right? It starts to look like Google Glass. And I think Apple, I would be more I don't know, enthusiastic about or maybe optimistic about the fact that they're going to actually release something if they had gone in the direction of AR, where this is a device that needs an iPhone and gives you a little bit of a heads up display that's powered by the iPhone wirelessly or something, and is a third accessory, right? Because they've had huge success with AirPods as an accessory. They've had huge success with the Apple Watch. Those are both essentially iPhone accessories. Mm-hmm. And another iPhone accessory, that would seem to be a slam dunk. But I just think the technology is not ready yet for that. And I think that's what they wanted to do. And they'd spent a lot of money on it. And it seems like then they went into the reality thing because it looked like there was a there. And all of a sudden it looks like, you know, everybody has left the party. And if other than HTC and a few like diehards, but there's not good content. Even Apple, most of their developer content that they've been focusing on the past like 3 to 5 years has all been AR, not VR. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been developing really great developer kits and working closely with developers. They have a nice ecosystem that's growing in AR. VR is like a complete unknown. So they might release something. Clearly they have something ready to be released and have been demoing it to some people, some insiders. But it just seems like this is a really train wreck waiting to happen if they do it. And this is not something, they are such a conservative company. They are very, very conservative about releasing new things. We see that everything is so incremental that Apple does now, that this would be, I would be shocked, almost surprised. And I know that's not the popular opinion or the consensus, but if they actually release this at WWDC, I don't think it's going to happen.
Release or show?
Show. Maybe they will show it. That's true. That's a good asterisk. They might show it and say released at the end of the year. And then that still gives them the out to at the end of the year, say, you know what, this still needs some time. Yeah. And they might, you know, charging pad this device and just, you know, put it back under the shelf and nobody ever hears from it again. In that case,
it ends up, a developer version of the device ends up on eBay in 10 years for some astronomical amount. Yeah. Could happen.
You can, very, very simple. Like what Jason just described, cost benefit. Like what is there to gain? Like what market share is there for them to take? How many users are there for the Apple to acquire versus what are the risks? And the risks are tremendous. So if they just, I mean, they could show it like Jason said and say, hey, it's a developer preview. You know, there's only going to be a certain amount and we'll iterate on this product over time. But why? Why not just wait? Why not just wait and release, just like Jason said, something that's AR. It's not called VR kit. It is called AR kit. Release something that's AR in a few years. And look, your Apple Watch and your AirPods already are fantastic peripherals for AR, right? The AirPods do great listening and peripheral listening. One of the problems that you have with everybody has with VR is that you shut out the rest of the world.
I have
an infant toddler. I can't shut out the rest of my world to like get on a VR call when I could just Zoom. But AR, especially if I have AirPods that listen and have haptics and I have a watch that does haptics and can notify me of events, then suddenly I'm in an environment that's a lot more conducive to having a pair of glasses on my face. In a couple years.
Is it safe to say the only like real market for VR with the headsets or what have you is going to be on the industrial side of things more so than in the consumer entertainment side?
Not even that. Microsoft canned HoloLens over a year ago. So, and they're really, I mean, I covered that. I had a HoloLens and there was just like every use case was just stretching it. Like there were really cool B2B things that could happen potentially and looked really neat, but just weren't practical and weren't actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, same could be said for Google Glass and the Enterprise Edition, you know, because Google, yeah, that was their pivot, was, okay, well, this isn't really for consumers anymore, but, you know, the Enterprise is going to come in really handy. And yes, there were, you know, occasional stories where they would highlight how it is being used in the Enterprise, but I highly suspect that was not the norm. You know, that was definitely, you know, the exception to the rule. Yeah, and of
the
course,
the idea still is running so far ahead of the reality on this. It's a terrible pun, but you know, it's just not there yet, right? The ideas are farther, much further advanced than the capabilities. At CES, I tried the new HTC Vive headset, which really has the latest capabilities. This is all they do, you know, primarily. This is the main thing that they do. They're so focused on it. They've got the latest technology in this device. I tried it. I thought at the time there were some really interesting pieces of it. It's as far as it could get, but within 48 hours, I'd completely forgot about it, was moved on to anything else, and really haven't hardly thought about it since, right? There's just not enough in it for it to be that interesting right now. And I just have to believe that Apple sees that they have there's not an echo chamber there, and they know that this is not good, and there's not enough of a there, and we aren't going to release it. I trust Mark Gurman's sources. I think that, you know, Mark Gurman has been, you know, spot on many, many times about these kinds of things, but I, you know, we're still 2 months away from, or almost a month and a half away, a little over a month and a half away from WWDC. There's still plenty of time for Apple to pull the plug and say, like, it's just not enough.
For sure. And would not be surprised in any way if that happened. Yeah. He wrote that Apple is, you know, looking at this device as the future beyond iPhone and iPad. We've heard that before. but which is just, it's really hard for me to envision that, you know.
No.
Both of those things are way more palatable for the everyday person. And if you're looking for a device category that begins with those as the example, we want the next one of these, it's got to be as consumer palatable as those things. And the reality is, those things, you know, those iPhone, a smartphone fits very easily into your pocket. It really does not take much other than cost. Expense, you know, is the primary thing to use one of those. And the success of the smartphone industry has bared that to be true, obviously, because everybody has these things now. I just don't see it when it comes to anything that you're putting on your head. And maybe I'm short-sighted. You know, Mark Zuckerberg sure thought we were short-sighted, and that's why he named the company Meta. And look where we're at right now. Like, it really does seem like he's wearing an egg on his face, you know? So I don't know.
His lawyers are working hard to roll that back.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Now, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. We'll see. But anyways. Yeah. And I mean, according to his report also, the initial plan, according to Mark Gurman, was that the headset was going to be introduced in March and sold publicly by September. Well, that obviously did not happen. Now it's to be introduced at WWDC, sold by the end of the year. Even that, I just feel like, is just, God, if Apple's actually releasing this thing, they better know something we don't, as far as all this stuff is concerned, because right now it really looks like a very misguided direction, in my opinion. And this is coming from somebody. I have the Meta Quest. I have the Meta Quest 2, and I've spent a lot of time in them, but I've also spent a lot of time in the last 6, 8, 10 months, I'd say, not in them. You know, it's like, I had this big moment, I can you know, narrow down to like a solid year, I'd say year and a half, where I was all about it. And then at some point it just became too much for me. Like, when I go into that world, you know, I didn't used to, but now I don't necessarily feel 100%. Like, it's not like I need to throw up or something, but I don't feel good. You know, I don't feel perfect like I did before I put the headset on. And that's enough of a detraction to be like, I don't have the energy for it tonight. And so it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So what has Apple got that's different than that? I don't know. I don't know what they could have.
We did a story at CBS News, and we shot the entire story in Horizon Worlds. Like, everything. We shot it just like you would a regular stand-up or a package, but everything was in Horizon Worlds in VR. Nice. And we even recreated the CBS News broadcast center, and, you know, there were functioning camera angles and all that. And like, Jason Howell, it came down to exactly that point. Like, we would get on meetings and go, oh, let's just do a Zoom.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh man, I like, do I have to get that thing? I wear glasses. Like, do I got to fit this to my face and then scratch my glasses and then go.
And to what benefit? I mean, there is this idea of like extra presence. And I would agree that when I'm standing in a room with someone talking to them, that feels better than sitting in front of a screen, talking to them on a screen. But I don't know that the standing in a room talking to someone experience is the same as standing in a virtual room talking to that same person in a virtual way, but realistic kind of, you know what I mean? They don't translate. I don't get the same benefit out of one that I do out of the other. So then why am I? I don't know. I don't even
know. We've seen all these. We've seen all these Star Trek and Star Wars holograms, and we're like, we're almost there with this. Like, we're not even close. And the path there is rough. And so people are not going to be ready to spend money on it when they have that as their vision of what it is and could be. You know, when you get to the reality of what it is today, it just doesn't feel like it's really worth the time or effort.
Yeah. What is the there?
we were in a very similar spot with the Apple car, maybe a half dozen years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, just the next quarter. They were going to announce it by the end of the year. Right. Yeah. There seemed to be parallels.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So
all of the headsets they've made already are right now, they're getting packed into the trunk of the Apple car, you know, to be shipped to an unknown location.
Look, it's hard times for tech companies right now. You got to do what you got to do to save on costs. So I understand. Let's take a break and we'll get back and, you know, talk more awesome news stories with an awesome panel. Dan Patterson, so great to get the chance to podcast with you, man. I'm usually booking you for this show, so it's nice to be able to be on the same show with you. Same for Jason Heiner, ZDNet. Same for my friend and coworker here at Twit, Ant Pruitt. This is just a heck of a lot of fun, so I appreciate you guys being here.
My man.
This show, this episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Decisions. Decisions gives IT and business experts the tools to automate anything in your company. Automation, we've already talked about it a lot on this show, right? It's so empowering. But the cool thing about Decisions, it's all within one no-code platform. No code, and you can automate the things that you normally do and make your life easier, make the lives of your employees easier. Decisions is proven to fix any business process and prepare you to withstand economic uncertainty in the process. Recession resilience, it requires a deliberate management of resources, and you also need the flexibility to adapt at a moment's notice. Well, the Decisions no-code environment makes it easy for your team to collaborate, to build and adjust workflows, also dynamic forms and decisioning processes that fit your unique and ever-changing business needs. This is especially important with today's IT talent shortage. Decisions process automation software is a complete toolkit. It allows developers and business users alike to build applications and automations without requiring any code, like I said, and that's the magic of Decisions. Their no-code platform is powerful. It includes robust rules and workflow engines, a host of pre-built integrations to keep things easy for you, that you can connect to any legacy system via API, all within a simple drag-and-drop visual interface design. So it's just dead simple. It can be deployed on-prem. It can be deployed in the cloud, if that's your preference. Companies, as you know, we were all caught flat-footed at the onset of the pandemic. It really took everybody by surprise. But Decisions customers were fully equipped to respond. One of the country's largest private banks built an entire PPP loan application process for small businesses affected by COVID-19. All it took them was just 2 days to do it. They, in essence, were the first to market, issuing $1 billion in loans before their competitors even started. That's the value of being there first, right? Decisions made that happen. Decisions lets you customize workflows to automate the small decisions in your workplace, producing faster results with greater accuracy, allowing your team to focus on the important decisions that they're making. You can scale your business from there to better serve your customers while reducing operational costs and saving your team valuable time. And, you know, there's a lot of examples. This is one excellent example of how decisions automation software can help. And you can notice it when you're riding in an Otis elevator. They implemented decisions to run daily pulse checks across their 2 million units, operating globally. By finding potential problems before they occur, which is the point, they avoid downtime, they manage their service technicians efficiently. So when you're riding on an Otis elevator, you know that you're going to arrive safely as a result of the decisions on the back end. As a recession approaches, the durability of a business's foundation will directly impact its performance and its ability to survive. So it's important to ask yourself, how strong is your foundation? Well, Decisions Automation Platform provides a solution to any business challenge. It automates anything, and that, in essence, changes everything for you to improve your company's speed to market, your financial growth, and operational success. They help industry leaders alleviate bottlenecks and automate pain points in their business so you can do what you do best, and that's change the world. To learn more about Decisions No-Code Automation Platform and scope your free proof of concept, all you got to do is visit decisions.com/twit. That's decisions.com/twit. And we thank Decisions for their support of This Week in Tech. Okay, what else do we have here? We've done the fun Apple rumory thing. I know you're going to like this one, Ant. The TikTok ban. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry I had to do this to you. But hey, it's in the news, so we should talk about it a little bit. So on This Week in Google, we talked briefly about this story that was in here about progressive lawmakers starting to kind of change, or there's a group of progressive lawmakers that are really pushing back on this idea of a TikTok ban. There's news, though, that came this week that in the state of Montana, this was actually just on Friday, actually. So just a couple of days ago, they approved a first of its kind bill. The goal or the target is to ban TikTok across the state. So this would be the first state in the U.S. to actually put this forward in a bill and to try and tamp down on TikTok use in the state. I don't know what that means for someone if they're VPNing, because I have a really hard time picturing the Utes of today not using their TikTok. It's so embedded right now. But what are your thoughts about this? Like, is this so far overblown? Is there something there? Is Montana, like, do they know something that we don't know? What do you guys think?
It feels like politics and not so much tech. I mean, yeah. Like China does similar things, right? They ban or put contingencies on the use of apps not built in China. And yeah. I mean, this push to, I don't know, I don't have any sources on this, but this push to ban TikTok feels more like a diplomatic tete-a-tete as opposed to a tech issue. Having said that, I don't put TikTok on my phone. I don't put WhatsApp on my phone. But I try to not put social media on my phone in general.
That was my next question. Like, how does that line up with other social media? Are you not putting TikTok on your phone because of the trust issue? Or is it just social media in general controlling the data that flows out of your phone in any way possible? And this is just another one of the many apps.
More about the data flowing in.
Oh, interesting.
I just don't need more brain-bending social media.
Okay. So it has nothing to do with, like, what are they doing with my zeros and ones? And it's more just like, I want to simplify my life. I have those concerns.
I think that there are concerns, especially about key logging and other, like, what they can see. Like, there are definitely concerns, but my concerns are personal. And that's that, like, I think that exposure to social media is something that, personally, like, I want to increase my exposure to books and decrease my exposure to social media, and that's what I try to do.
You know, I'm glad Patterson's on here. I know he has gone to different tech events and whatnot all around the world, including going into you know, across the pond, if you will, for an event. And I know, as his friend, he has taken certain security measures. I'm not going to say what they are, but he has taken certain security measures when he's gone to these events because he's wanting to make sure things are squared away with his privacy and so forth. And I've always applauded his efforts for that stuff. But then when stories like this come out, and just as he said, this is sounds more political than tech here. It pisses me off because TikTok can scrape and be a so-called threat to us from a privacy standpoint or security standpoint, what have you, just as much as any of these homegrown apps here in the U.S. can. You know, we've had, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes ago where everybody in the country was talking about just how bad social media was for children and making the children depressed and wanting to commit suicide or leading to violence because of something they saw on Instagram or because of something they saw on Facebook or what have you. But there was never any mentions then of we need to ban Facebook and Instagram, you know? So it seems really, really political to just sort of single out TikTok when we could say the same stuff about our very own homegrown apps here.
No, and likely man, those apps have.
Them. Granted, I don't want them popping in and saying, you know what, Mr. Pruitt, your son is under 18. He cannot use Instagram. And I'm going to tell the government where to stick it because he's my child. Let me manage that. And when I hear these different policies, I'm always thinking, OK, I know there are bad parents out there, but parents can step in and help manage these issues with social media, in my opinion.
Jason, you know, I worked for Jason. I've reported from Darfur, from Cairo, the UAE, Kenya. But Jason, you know, I worked for you when I went to Kyiv in 2017. And I mean, I was in retrospect, I'm like, I should have just like breathe. But I like that was terrifying. The group, I'm not important. I'm just a schmuck journalist, but the Secretary of State was with us and there were other high level diplomats and we were followed by people who were, I mean, just thugs. We were staying right next to FSB and we were live streaming. This was the Global Cybersecurity Summit and they were speaking on cyber policy, high level diplomats. And so again, I'm a schmuck, but everybody coming out of there, all of our phones were being monitored. And Jason, you know, I used Signal. I talked to the team back home, but I took every app off of my phone that wasn't Signal. I spent a couple of weeks in Cairo training Sudanese migrants how to use encryption on mobile devices. I did the same thing. I took every app off my phone because your data is, in that case, was being monitored by the state. But look, the data that streams out of your apps on your phone is this no joke. It's no joke. Like we should be concerned about data privacy, but to your point, Ant, we should probably be concerned about those homegrown apps as much as TikTok. And right. Look, it just feels
grandstanding.
Like
all of them are a mess.
Right. Like it just feels like maybe this is a little more about diplomacy than it is the app, but I don't know.
Yeah. You know, there are not a lot of smart things that have come out of the debate about this, to be clear. But I did see one, not here, but just in the larger, like, you know, TikTok ban, conversation. I'm sorry to say that, but one of the smartest things, I did see one senator whose name I'm now forgetting, apologies, who said, you know, the thing is, some of this is just all visuals. Like we could say, okay, TikTok, you have to put your data in Texas, right? They have this movement where they're going to like, no, we'll store all of the data in Texas. And so, and we'll somehow make ourselves feel better that the Chinese government can't, you know, get at it as easy in Texas. He says, look, the Chinese government has shown no restraint. Whether it's in China, whether it's in Texas, whether it's in Europe, that they will break in. Yeah, this senator says this. They will try to break in, and I'm not confident that they're not in any of it. You know, at any time that they want, and they've shown no compunction to have any restraint. So why would we? You know, we're fooling ourselves that we think that we're going to be safer by making them store their data in Texas. I thought that was actually probably the smartest thing anybody has said in this this whole debate of like a lot of this is optics, right? We're trying to make ourselves feel better that the Chinese about the Chinese government not having access to American data by not allowing TikTok to operate in the United States. We're fooling ourselves. It's not going to solve anything. I'll add one other thing about social media, because I'm also going to admit that when it comes to social media, I also have done, I've pulled it back on a lot of it. I used to do a ton of it. Dan and I met on social media originally, like 2008, 2009. And then Dan and I did a podcast in 2018 that I think you can still find out there. But in 2018, we both said we were deleting Facebook and Instagram off of our phones. We were going to stop using a lot of Twitter. And the funny thing is, Dan and I both said we had this goal because we were using it all the time, every day. It was part of our job. We're using it hours and hours. And when you started, I think we had had this conversation before the podcast episode that when you start adding that up, you realize how much of your life you're dedicating to it. Yeah. And it got to the point where it was like, this is a lot of time. That's just not, there's not a good ROI on our time. Mm-hmm. So I remember saying on that podcast, I was going to do one thing for a year. I was going to pretty much go semi-retired on social media. And I was going to do two things. I was going to read more books because I also realized I hadn't read a book in a year at the time we had done. I hadn't read a complete book in 1 year.
Wow.
And then I also was using Facebook as a way to keep up with people. And I was not actually having phone calls with people. I was not having coffee or lunch. So I said, in this 1 year, I'm going to read books and I'm going to have real life. I'm going to call people and I'm going to go out and have coffee and lunch with just, you know, the people that I have the access to do that when I travel and at home. My life was so much better in that 1 year that I said it was going to be a year. And then I sort of forgot about, you know, whatever the date was that I was supposed to like go off of this sabbatical, this social media sabbatical. Cause I was like, my life, I'm never going back to, you know, spending hours and hours a day on social media. It's just the ROI for that, yeah, for my mental health and the quality of life is just not good enough.
So is that still a constant now at this point?
It is
the same thing. Yeah. Cause I was, as you were explaining, I was like, and then after a year, I'm going right back, but no, I'm happy that wasn't
I deleted Facebook, not just the app from my phone, but I deleted my Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp accounts. I had to make WhatsApp to talk to some sources a couple months ago, but I've since deleted it.
Dan went a step further than I did. I didn't delete them, but kudos to Dan for
I just felt like Facebook was a net negative and my slash blade on it was pretty high. Twitter was a net positive for a long time, and it could be again. Anytime I'm a gamer, so if you do it in most major video games, if you pull up your console and you do slash played, like a slash and type played, it'll tell you like World of Warcraft 14 days, right? But what is your slash played on social media?
Like, God, do we actually want to know the answer to that question? It would probably, probably make it.
And what's
really
the ROI
bad?
To Jason's point, like in Twitter, you know, the ROI was pretty big, pretty substantial. Like it was absolutely a benefit, but all the other social was like, and even those apps, like it pulling them off my phone. It sounds silly. I know people have strong opinions about Amazon and I'm not raising an Amazon debate, but like I bought a Kindle late last year and I mean, it changed my life. I don't touch my phone in bed. I read every single night for hours. It is the best device. I would get rid of all of my other devices if I could keep my Kindle.
Mm. Kindle on a flip phone is all you need.
Yeah.
I'm the same way though.
Kindle. Flip phone.
Hey, there's a big movement back into flip phones right now.
I was talking about the Motorola Razr. Okay. Sorry. The Kindle though, it really is true because it's because of not having that backlight and also not having any other apps on it. When I did say I was going to go off of, social and spend more time reading, I did that. I bought a Kindle. It was a Kindle Oasis. It's still the one 5 years later that I'm reading on today. I would do a slash plate on that. And there kind of is a version where you can see, here are the books you read so far this year. Yeah. Here's your goal. And, it's kind of nice because that, then I sort of see, I feel like there's an ROI right there of like, I'm fooling myself to say like, I like the ROI there, in terms of reading. And I also listen to some things. There's some good other, apps. One of the things that I really like, a great trend, is the apps like Blink and some others that do summaries of books. Because then you can get the summaries of a lot of things. And then if you're really into them, because most books have one, two, maybe three good ideas in them, and the rest is all evidence. But if you can get that 15 to 20 minute summary of books, then you can decide, oh, I'd like to go and either read that or listen to the audio book or whatever. So I've found that to be another thing where the ROI on that feels really, really high. There's like three or four of these apps now that do that summarize books into like 15 to 20 minute little snippets. And I find that another life hack. Sorry, I know we're not talking life hacks here. So back to you, Jason Howell.
I think we are, because apparently we moved on from TikTok, because I mean, it sounds like we're kind of all in somewhat agreement that maybe this is a little silly and definitely more political than it is actual technology. But I appreciate where the conversation has headed, because I think the wellness aspect around how we're using technology, there was this movement, you know, 4 or 5 years ago where, you know, Google and Apple were putting all these wellness features into their phone. And there was, you know, a little bit, there were the people that that appreciated having those controls. And then there were people that were like, don't tell me how to use my technology, blah, blah, blah. I have noticed for myself that probably about 5 or 6, I can't remember when it was exactly. I want to say it was like 5 or 6 years ago. I left Facebook entirely, deleted my account. I realized that when I used Facebook, I came out the other end having, you know, spent all that time there, and I didn't feel better. I felt worse. You know, it was this idea that like I'm subjecting myself to this experience that on the other side of it, you know, part of it was just, it was a very politically heated moment in time. And, you know, it was just like, why am I spending my time feeling bad? What would happen if I just removed it? And, you know, a lot of things improved in my life. But I'm also conflicted, because about a year ago, I signed up for a new Facebook account and came back, not because I wanted to be exposed to political anything. I haven't, you know, engaged with anything like that. And honestly, I don't see it. So I'm obviously doing something right. But just because I did feel, Jason, like I can appreciate and respect that you were able to remove yourself and maintain all of those relationships on a phone call or a sit down or whatever. I do way more of that now than I did, 5 or 6 years ago, no question. But there's still like a lot of life that I don't see out of the people that I care about. And that seems to be the only way that I can actually get that connection and just, you know, to understand what's going on in people's lives. So my approach to it now after having that distance is very different. I probably only open the app a couple of times a week, maybe 2 times a week. And when I do, it's very specific. Like, what are my friends up to right now? It's just the good stuff. And I'm okay with that. But
I use word of mouth for that.
You know, transitioning.
My wife is still on Facebook, so my wife tells me when something interesting that I would like.
Yeah,
you know, you log in, or she'll just screenshot it and text it to me. Like,
there you go.
Such and such. Here's their life event, and so,
I'm probably I use Twitter, but I don't. I'm not going to necessarily say I'm on Twitter, because I don't respond as much as I used to.
Yeah,
neither do I. Even back before the acquisition, I noticed a change in Twitter, in my Twitter experience, because I'd open it up where this in the browser on my phone, and the fuss for most people was the stuff that was being fed to them was really, you know, people that are not following and what have you. You know, just like, none of this matters to me. My feed wasn't necessarily like that. It was a lot of the people that I follow, but what was being served was the anger and hate, frustration from the people that I follow. And I got tired of seeing that, because it was just depressing. You know, I didn't get to see all of the viral videos of people having these weird fights in the street and stuff like that. Fortunately, I didn't see most of that stuff. But what I did see was still a bit of a downer. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go into broadcast mode. And so for me, if you look at my feed, a lot of my stuff is automated. It's just going out all day long because I'm a broadcaster. And if it's, if Twitter's going to get me one more listener to Hands On Photography, if it's going to get me one more person to order a print, antpruitt.com/prints, I'm fine with that. But for the most part, it's just straight up broadcast mode. And every now and then I go and answer a reply, but not often.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I totally agree. My participation has gone down, and I think I'm okay with it.
And I'm fine. And even with Instagram, Instagram has changed for me too. Now that I think about it, Twitter and Instagram have changed again since about November of last year. I went into full broadcast campaign mode for my son. So now if you look at Instagram or look at Twitter, you'll see some things about Twit in there and Hands On Photography. But most of the time you're going to see my son in there because I'm just trying to push him and promote him because I think he's getting screwed when it comes to these dadgum colleges out there. But that's another rant for another day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, either way, I use the platforms, but I'm not on the platforms.
Yeah. I understand.
Instagram and TikTok, and do you put your stuff out for your son on Instagram and TikTok?
My TikTok has my son on it. That's it's not me on there. It's him.
Yeah. Now, does your son have a TikTok account?
No, he does not.
No,
he does not.
Is I'm totally curious, and you don't have the answer, but is your son interested in social the way you?
Yes, he actually has two Instagram accounts because he's a creator himself. He has a private Instagram account that I don't have access to, but I don't care because I trust him. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, he's a turd sometimes, but I trust him. I know he's not going to be doing crazy stuff. But he has his public account where, you know, he does this photography and because he likes to shoot and he also likes to model and he likes to sew because he's into fashion and stuff. So he does put stuff out there.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
There are ways to use these things that aren't soul crushing things, you know, experiences. it's important to remember that. Right. Let's take a quick break. And then when we come back from the break, got a couple of like little bits of stories here and there to round things out with. But let's take a moment and thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, and that is ExpressVPN. I'm a huge fan of ExpressVPN. Had them on my phone, had them on my computer for years. Profiling, surveillance, data harvesting, some of this stuff probably sounds pretty familiar based on what we've been talking about today. These are a lot of things not to like about the tech giants, right? But what can you actually do about it when you rely on so many of their products? We don't all have $44 billion to go buying Twitter, but the good news is you don't have to be a billionaire to take a stand. I use ExpressVPN on all my devices, like I said, for less than $7 a month. You can join me and fight back against all of this data harvesting, big tech, by using ExpressVPN. And of course, the easy example here is you go to a public space, public Wi-Fi, coffee shop, you know, you're logging onto the Wi-Fi there. Prime example of where you can use VPN. And if you've ever used VPN before in any public space, you may have noticed like a slowdown in what you're getting. It's like, oh, well, I turn on the VPN and things just don't seem as snappy. I mean, that's one of the things that I think I love most about ExpressVPN is I turn on that VPN and I don't notice a difference. Like, I just don't notice a difference. It's awesome. They've got, you know, different points of presence across the world. Across the map. So you probably have one very close to you, and that's going to keep things going fast. It's a pretty impressive experience. How do you think big tech companies make all their money? They do it by tracking your searches, your video history, everything you click on, and then selling your personal data. ExpressVPN helps you anonymize much of your online presence by hiding your IP address, which if you aren't aware, you probably are, but it's a unique identifier for every device. This allows big tech to match your activity back to you, right? It's a very specific target, targeted just to you. And the best part here is how easy it is to use the ExpressVPN app. Like I said, I push the button. It's literally a simple tap. I just tap one button on my phone, one button on my computer, and I turn it on. And that's all it takes to keep people out of my business. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your data, your personal data for profit, it's time to fight back. Visit expressvpn.com/twit right now. You'll get 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/twit. One more time for the people in the back row, expressvpn.com/twit. You'll be happy you did it. I'm telling you, it's the VPN to use. It's the VPN that I trust and I use. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Tech. We had a great week this week on Twit. Sans Leo, but he's coming back, so you aren't going to have to wait too much longer. Let's see what's so great about the last week on Twit.
Yeah, we're hanging out here in Club Twit with my man, Mr. Victor. I really appreciate all of you all hanging out here with us. I'm looking here in the Discord. John A. says, I have a question for Ant and Victor. What do you want from Starbucks? Dude, only at Twit.
Previously on Twit. Hands-on Windows.
Coming up on Hands-on Windows, we're going to take a look at the top five productivity apps in Windows 11. And number four is going to really surprise you.
Security Now.
Can ChatGPT keep a secret that some employees of Samsung Semiconductor were using ChatGPT to help in their diagnosis and repair of some problematic proprietary Samsung code? The only problem was the uploads contain Samsung's sensitive proprietary information. Samsung warned its employees against using ChatGPT in their daily work. While the company develops its own internal ChatGPT-like AI for its own private use.
Home Theater Geeks.
I chat with Tomlinson Holman, the TH in THX. As the show is called Home Theater Geeks, it's the perfect place for you, Tom Holman, to come and talk about super geeky stuff.
Where do I join?
Twit.
No membership needed. You are a charter member without question.
Beer. I can't hear the letters THX and not think of the big sound effect from the movies.
Deep sound, wasn't that the phrase for it?
Was that? I don't know. Did it have a title other than THX sound?
Yeah, it had an actual title. I think it's like deep sound or deep noise or something like that. Chat room will confirm.
Sound. Let's see here. THX deep note.
Deep note. Yes.
Composed by Lucasfilm sound engineer Dr. James Andy Moore. First screened 1983 premiere of Star Wars. What is that? Is that six? No. Yeah. Return of the Jedi. Yeah. Interesting. I didn't know that played in the theaters that early. I thought it was like a mid to late 80s thing. Anyways, certainly didn't play before any football games, and it's a horrible segue, but we all know that YouTube TV is getting the Sunday ticket, the NFL Sunday ticket, which had stayed, which had called DirecTV its home for decades. It was possible that it was going to go to Apple. Now it's certainly going to YouTube TV, and now we have a pricing for it. For any of the football fans out there, I don't know. Maybe there are not that many, but $349 a year if you want the Sunday ticket package through YouTube TV. That's a pretty penny for some NFL football, if I do say so myself. I don't know if I'll be paying for it. Well, actually, I do know I won't be paying for it. But what about you?
I'm right there with you, bro. No. It's no different from when DirecTV had it. From a pricing standpoint, you're getting the football season and you're paying well over $300 or what have you.
Yeah.
But the football season isn't a full year. And you sometimes the game experience isn't necessarily what you would hope it would be. Because if you're watching your team play in the other market or what have you, because they weren't able to you know, because you're not able to see him any other regular time. You get the broadcast team that isn't necessarily the A broadcast team. So sometimes that screws with the experience. And I it's just not worth it. You know, you get 5 months out of the year for this package. You don't even get the full 12 months. It's, they got to bring something else to the table. And
I know it's not comparable, but the price of an MLB.com subscription is $149. But they have the same challenges, and is that, you know, and the same when baseball streams on Apple or on Amazon or elsewhere, that I want my local announcers. I want to know, I have a parasocial relationship with them. I want to feel like Michael Kay is saying horrible things in my ears. Like when Aaron Judge was pursuing the home run record last year, there was a possibility that it wouldn't be his hometown anchors calling the game. Now, it's great for Apple and Amazon to help diversify the space, but like, and Google, but
hey, sports care about this stuff, man.
Yeah.
When you say 149, is that 149 a year or a month or what?
A year. But there's still big blackout restrictions. Oh, like you can't watch out of market games and teams, at least like the Yankees. I don't know other teams, but like the Yankees through YES have their own television network and they have their own radio network. So they have their own app and, you know, you can listen to Yankee games on MLB, but you like, if you want to watch, you're on YES.
Interesting.
Yeah, the unwinding of all these rights, these old antiquated rights around different kinds of broadcasting is certainly happening right in front of us. And I think then at the same time, we have the streaming wars, which, so while the old television system is still unwinding, we have the streaming wars, which are I think about to get apocalyptic because people are so over stretched on their streaming service subscriptions, and you hear it again and again, right? Consumers talking about it, and I think are ready to start, you know, dumping some subscriptions, and then consumers getting hit pretty hard. Inflation, it's been a couple years now, and the drag on that is really strong, and you see that in, you know, the levels of debt rising. You know, I think the certainly the golden age of streaming, or at least paying for streaming subscriptions, is over, and it's tough to see who's going to survive that. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people, but I think that the companies that are best set up to win the streaming wars are not necessarily the ones you'd think of. I think they are Apple, Amazon, and Google, because Apple and Amazon have subscriptions that people already pay for and get other stuff. And they're like, fine, you know, it's in there. I'm not going to, I'll keep paying for Apple One or Prime, my Amazon Prime subscription. And that the fact that the video is in there, well, you know, that just gives them so much more leverage, operating leverage over all these other stream subscriptions. And then you have Google with YouTube, where they're still sucking up so many of the eyeballs. That's not really a good analogy, but you get that. they're still capturing a lot of the attention. And so, you know, the fact that they are doing it all the way from now YouTube Shorts, which is rapidly drawing some audience from TikTok. And then you're on the complete other end. I you know, to bring it back to this story, on the complete other end, you have them now being the host of probably the most valuable subscription in the world, which is TV, you know, this 5 month, $350 subscription for the NFL that people will actually pay for, enough people will actually pay for, that it is insanely profitable. I think that puts YouTube in a really, really strong position from a viewing standpoint. And ultimately all these platforms go where the eyeballs go, and the winners consolidate around where the eyeballs are.
Yeah. So, okay. So definitely along these lines, how do we feel about HBO Max becoming just Max? It's no longer HBO, the legacy name, no longer part of the name at all. You just got to know.
It sounds like the name of an AI.
I figured that was coming.
it feels like the name of an AI, you know, like Max. It's now not HBO Max. It's the name Max. Yeah, exactly. You just tell Max what Max, I'm interested in watching, you know, an action adventure movie that has, you know, this star in it that, you know, is rated this, and just show me all the options.
I saw the story, and via Tech News Weekly, Mr. Sargent and yes. Mr. Howell were talking about it because I didn't see it any prior to that. And I get their point, HBO Max, whoever they are, I get their point by dropping the name because if there's going to be a lot more children-friendly content there, I guess some parents could be concerned when they put that tag HBO on there, knowing that HBO wasn't necessarily kid-friendly for several decades. And it just makes more sense marketing-wise. It's nothing's going to change. You're still going to have the yeah. content that you're used to getting. It's just a branding
silly.
Thing.
It's kind of a silly
story. HBO yeah. has so much brand equity, though. Yes. Like, to do this, it'd almost be like Ford saying, we're not going to call ourselves Ford anymore. We're going to call ourselves Blue Oval. And, like, nobody's going to know what Blue Oval is, right? Where when you say that.
At the same time, Federal Express has been doing just fine the last couple of decades as FedEx.
On FedEx, but everybody calls them FedEx.
Totally. That's a little different. Close enough.
Yeah.
We all know what
there's
that is.
There's been other people out there that rebranded, and some of them are still.
It does feel like a Zaslav thing. I mean, it feels like you have to know the inside baseball on no pun intended, on what's happening at Warner and those media changes to really understand why this rename and rebrand happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in big trouble. Like the rest of those streaming ones we just talked about, like they're in big trouble.
Like every major media company.
Yes. Yes. And so they've got to do something. So to Ant's point, maybe rebranding is what they need because they need to not be pigeonholed into what they are, what they have been, and they need to be seen as something larger in order to survive.
Yeah, it could be like maybe HBO is a boomer brand.
If I want to watch reruns of Big Bang Theory, I'm not going to look on HBO Max. I'll probably look on Max before I look on HBO Max.
You might look on Paramount.
No, but it's on, it's on HBO Max now.
Oh, is it?
I believe.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a Paramount show.
CBS or something. One of those things. Yeah. But it's on HBO Max right now if I go and pull it up. But again, most people... Is it on Max? Okay, yeah, it's on Max. Boom, it's there. Same way we were doing things with Netflix before it got muddy.
Yeah. This is a story reminded me of the Netflix name change, which I brought up on TNW.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Remember when it was Quickster was the name.
Yes.
Of the
one
DVD.
Was going to be the DVD and the
other
was
and then the Netflix was streaming and Quickster was the DVD. And then they...
Boy, those were the good old days.
Oh, remember when that's what everybody was panicking about? What, we can't call it Netflix anymore? Yeah. Did anyone here play Wordle? Or sorry, well, Wordle, yes. We probably all played Wordle. Did you ever play Hurdle? It was the game that Spotify acquired, the music Wordle game.
I did not, sir, but I did run hurdles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, different. this is not Herd, H-U-R, but Herd, H-E-A-R-D. Oh. Hurdle, because it's a Spotify thing. Yeah. I do remember when the Wordle, like, obsession was happening, and it seemed to captivate everybody. There was, like, this gold rush on Wordle-inspired games, and everybody was buying them up. And Spotify's play was to buy this game called Hurdle, which would basically, it would play... the beginning part of a song five times and you'd have to guess the song and big surprise, it's done. That whole gold rush has fizzled out and Spotify is going to be closing it down. So if you're a big fan of Wordle inspired games, you're going to have one less to play. I don't even know.
I still play Wordle.
I just was never one of the people that shared my score.
Yeah.
Dadgum day.
Oh yeah.
I didn't play it ever. Not
I didn't either.
Not once.
I never played it.
Yeah. I played it.
I already think in words, man. I don't want that to be a game.
Words haunt you in your sleep already.
Yeah, that's true. I have spent enough of my time with words. I don't need it to be how I pass the time and enjoyment. And then I think maybe finally, I thought this was an article that could round out the show. friend of the show, Harry McCracken, the technologizer, wrote on technologizer.com about the end of computer magazines in America, because Maximum PC and Mac Life are both shipping their last print edition, moving to download, moving to digital. And he says, I'm not writing this article because the dead tree versions of Maximum PC and Mac Life are no more. I'm writing it because they were the last two extant U.S. computer magazines that had managed to cling to life until now. With their abandonment of print, the computer magazine era has officially ended. And that just kind of makes me kind of sad. Computer shopper. You know,
I didn't realize they were still around.
Yeah, I'm not reading them, but they were still printing.
I thought, whoa, I was interested in this. I was like, wow, they were actually still printing. I had no idea.
The only people that care is our age group.
No, totally. Oh, yeah. No question. This is purely a nostalgia story that I put in there because it reminds me of being a kid and looking at that fat, like honking, you know, issue of Computer Shopper that was just like hundreds of pages of storefronts with different, you know, like specced, you know, machines. And oh, yes, it was the whole thing.
I worked at the ancient history years ago, two decades ago, I worked at Copperfield's Books in Sebastopol and Petaluma.
Oh,
I would drive between those two stores
in the corner.
At the time, I was in charge of magazines. And with all magazines at the time, that was the early 2000s and magazines were still kicking. So you'd always over order because they would make up. And at the end of the week, you have extras and you have to prove to the publisher that you did not sell those. And I would sit in the back and strip those, especially those computer magazines. I would sit in the back of Copperfields and read the stripped magazine cover to cover, all of, and I felt like, wait, I'm reading a computer. Why don't I just use the internet? Anyway, it's a non sequitur, but I started my computer magazine reading at Copperfields, very close to you.
It was all your fault, Dan. Why didn't I just read it on the internet?
You know, if you worked in a bookstore bookstores, I'm sure people are listening who've worked in bookstores, and it's a travesty, but stripping books was pretty common. You know, you'd have way too many mass markets of some sci-fi book you totally wanted to read, so gotta strip that cover.
This reminds me of a story too. This magazine, the death of the computer magazine, reminds me of a story that I've maybe even told on Twit before, of like when I was in the 90s, I was in college, right, when the internet was hitting, you know, and I was studying journalism, and I had these arguments with journalism instructors. I was like, this internet thing, like, this is the future. Like and they were like, no, they tried this experiment down in Florida, you know, with like HyperCard and the thing is, look, people just don't want to read on screens. And I was like, it's instantaneous and it's so much cheaper. Like, you don't have any, you know, trucks going and delivering papers and paper, you know, carriers and all of that. And they're like, you know, it's just not going to happen. You think of it, you just don't have the serendipity of flipping through things and be able to see. And they said, you know, you should just get a job in magazines. I'm like, no, I want to work on the internet. Like, this is where the future this is. And they're like, just get it. Take the magazine class and get a job in magazines because you have a future there. So now, to be fair, they're right. Like, if I would have studied magazines, I could have had a job all the way up until 2023 or something, you know, maybe, actually probably not, maybe up until 2010 or something.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, but, I should have a few years off that for sure.
I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I sort of walked out and was like, yeah, they don't know what they're talking about. My, you know, teenage mind, I don't know what the heck they're talking about. They can't teach me anything. When in fact they could, 90% of what they were saying was really excellent. They just had this 10% were wrong. It just happened to be like a really important 10% at that moment.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, yes, Computer Shopper, of course, was a magazine that I have fond memories of, just because of the sheer like I mean, it was just gigantic. But my history with computer magazines goes back into the 80s when I had a Commodore 64, and it was, you know, all the magazines that you could get then, like Compute, where you get it and it would have like, you know, it would have some sort of machine language code that you could enter in manually into your computer, and you'd end up with a game on the other side, or you wouldn't, and then you'd have to go through line by line and troubleshoot it and everything. And so, yeah, I've got a fondness in my heart for the computer magazine. So when I saw this article, I was like, oh, okay. I need to take a couple of minutes to mourn the loss of the computer magazine.
One warm tear roll down your cheek.
Yeah, I'll say that one did, but one didn't, but it should have. If I was more of a computer nerd, a tear would have rolled down my cheek. So anyways, thanks to Harry McCracken for writing a really great article, as he does right all the time. And thanks to you three for being my guests on this episode of This Week in Tech, and for, I don't know, making this job easy. Sometimes I can admit filling Leo's shoes can be a little daunting because he's been doing this stuff for so long. So I was like, I gotta have some people that I know I can roll with on this panel, and you guys are great. So thank you for coming on with me today. Appreciate it.
Ah, thank you. Aunt Jason and Jason, it was great to see you again.
Good to see you too.
This was fun. You did great. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, Jason, you did a fantastic job.
Thank you. Dan, what do you want to leave people with? Blog.danpatterson.com. Where do you want to direct people if they want to support you?
Yeah, that's great. Blog.danpatterson.com is where I have the most recent ZDNet interviews with AI thought leaders. This is nothing to do with me. It's fascinating people talking about this emerging technology that is reshaping lives.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, everybody should follow your awesome work there, blog.danpatterson.com.
Or just click through to ZDNet.
ZDNet, and you'll find Dan there as well. It's great talking with you, Dan. Thank you.
You too.
And Jason Heiner, editor-in-chief of ZDNet. So even if Jason isn't writing the articles that you're seeing, he's certainly very, very ingrained in the the presentation of the articles. Tell us a little bit about what people can do to find you online, and what do you want to leave people with?
Yeah, you know, really, it's the work of folks like Dan, all of our writers and editors who are following on ZDNet, are following the most important developments. Our focus is on disruptive innovation, and there is so much of it happening. AI, of course, leading the charge, but since the beginning of the year, AI has taken off in such an amazing way. And from a curiosity standpoint of the audience, people are trying to get their heads around, what does this mean? What's happening? One of the things that I really love about what our team has done is really surrounded it with a 360 perspective. We're trying to look at it from every angle, not just repeat the hype and the echo chamber about what it's doing, but really pulling back and pulling apart the pieces of it and looking at it and observing it. And the work that Dan has done, interviewing really smart people and bringing those unique perspectives, all three of the interviews that are already up that Dan has done, all bring a very different perspective to the argument. And that's a symbol of kind of the work we're doing more broadly on AI and ChatGPT. You can come and you can learn how to use ChatGPT, how to make really good prompts. You can understand how ChatGPT works. We're doing all of those things and understanding AI in the broader spectrum. And then we're also looking at, of course, what are all the technologies that are happening, the products, and what are the most advanced and cutting edge ones and latest things happening, and how can you take advantage of them? Which ones are worth sort of taking advantage of and bringing in and trying out in your life, from robot vacuums to smartphones to software that you can use to help with your work and with your with your life. So that's what we do, ZDNet.com. We're also YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, all of the socials. You can find lots of great stuff there, and that's the best thing that I have to offer.
Right on. Well, thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure to get the chance to talk with you. And thank you. At Jason Heiner, by the way, on Twitter, but it sounds like you're not doing too much there. None of us are.
No, Twitter's dead. Also, Ann Pruitt, also not doing very much on Twitter, it seems. And thanks so much for carving out yet another Sunday. I realized after I asked you to do this that you were already covering for me on two of the Sundays while I was out. And then I felt really bad because I was like, oh, man, you're working so hard to enable me to take a vacation. So thank you, thank you, thank you for all of your help while I was gone. And thank you for being on this episode of This Week in Tech, because I love podcasting with you, man.
My pleasure, brother. My pleasure. I appreciate you.
And yeah.
Folks, make sure y'all watch my show, Hands On Photography, twitch.tv/HOP, and learn how to be a better photographer and post-processor, regardless of the phone or camera you have. I'm not going to get into all of the weeds about, well, you need an iPhone 18 plus pro. No, just grab a camera. Let's get out there and shoot.
Artist, working man, in podcast.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's true.
Keep it up, Ant.
You're put always that on my lower third, Mr. Jammer B.
You're always such a positive person. I love it. So thank you, Ant. As for, well, first of all, Club Twit. You need to know about Club Twit because it's become really important for us here at Twit over the last couple of years. Actually, Ant Pruitt makes a lot of the Club Twit things happen behind the scenes, as you saw in the promo. If you saw the promo, he sat down with Victor, one of the editors here, and so doing lots of really cool stuff on Club Twit. But what is Club Twit? It's basically, if you want all of our shows without any ads, if you want bonus content like that interview, there's, you know, Hands On Windows, Hands On Mac. Scott Wilkinson has the Home Theater Geeks show now. There's a bunch of content exclusive to Club Twit members. If you want access to our Discord, which is for members only, then Club Twit's where it's at. Twit.tv/Club Twit, $7 a month gets you all that stuff. But not only that, it helps us because, as y'all know, you know, podcast advertising, there's been some shaky ground in recent months, not just for us, but in general across the podcast market. And so you being a member actually helps support us directly. And we can't thank you enough for that because it really does help. So it keeps us all going. Yes.
Can I jump in here for a second?
Of course. Go for it.
All right. Regarding Club Twit, yes, we have our $7 a month and we have our annual plan, but we also have corporate group plans. So if you folks want to have your IT department join Club Twit, sign up at twit.tv/Club Twit. But we also have family plans. So you can get a family plan as 2 seats for $12, and you can also increase those seats. And you can even get a family annual plan, just again, just do the math, $12 times 12, whatever that math is, and increase the seats. And also, folks that are members of Club Twit, we just had our book club, and we're going to have another book club meeting on June 29th. So if you're a member right now, please go in and vote on the next book that we're going to read. And we'll have our meeting on June 29th with Mrs. Stacy Higginbotham. The book club has been a lot of fun and it's been exposing me to a bunch of sci-fi stuff that I would never read at my own. You know, it's been a lot of fun. So make sure you folks check us out. And thank you for all of the support of Club Twit.
Yes, indeed. Twit.tv/Club Twit. Thank you, Ann. As for this show, twit.tv/twit. If you go there, you're going to find all the ways to subscribe. We do this show every Sunday starting at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. So if you want to watch live, you certainly can. Twit.tv/live is our live feed with our chats and everything happening in real time. But really, you need to subscribe. And you can do that at twit.tv/twit. We hope that you will. And that's all there is to it. I'm Jason Howell. Catch me on All About Android. Actually, I'm filling in for Leo on Security Now and This Week in Google this next upcoming week, as well as Tech News Weekly and All About Android. So I'll be really busy. So I'll be looking for you all there as well. Thank you for allowing me to crash this party for 1 week. Had a lot of fun. And with that, another Twit is in the can. Thanks, everybody.